with me, Sue Perkins.
Bring it, my little sausage.
Oh, these things are going to run me out of town.
Monday nights at 6:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
This is Radio 4 on 92 to 95 FM on BBC Sounds and your smart speaker.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 30th of January. This is Today with Amol Rajan in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
The headlines this morning, President Trump has warned the UK that boosting trade ties with China is dangerous. As Sir Keir Starmer told business leaders in Beijing, he wanted mutual trust and respect. Attacks in Ukraine have reduced sharply in intensity after Donald Trump urged President Putin not to bomb the country during the extreme cold weather.
We'll get the latest from Kyiv very soon. Also in today's programme, we're going to be doing something a little different, taking a long, hard look at social media, phones and screen time. So if you're a parent or a carer who is trying to deal with the challenges of managing how your children use it at home, we're going to try and help. We'll look at some of the key issues over the next few hours. And from 8:30 this morning, the programme will be dedicated to what we can do to make things better. Now, hundreds of you have been getting in touch with us all week to share your concerns.
We both kind of feel that phones have somewhat ruined our experience of parenting.
I too poisoned my relationship with my teenagers, trying to control their smartphone and social media use. But I think it is possible to put limits on it. But it takes really strong parenting to do it.
The social media ban is a starting point. Of course it can be circumvented, but it sends a clear message that we need to think about the use of digital media carefully.
There's so much to deal with, isn't there? And this morning we'll be talking crucially as well about possible solutions.
The first principle, this is the one I wish I'd done, is no screens of any kind in bedrooms ever. This stuff is like a gas that expands to fill every moment. So if you have that rule, it won't fill every moment of your kid's day.
Much more to come on that, but we start this morning with the BBC News read for us today by Tom Sanders.
President Trump has claimed it would be dangerous for the UK to do more business with China as the Prime Minister works to strengthen economic ties with the country on the third day of his trip there. Mr Trump's warning is similar in tone to the Conservatives, who've accused the Prime Minister of kowtowing to a country which conducts daily espionage. This morning, Sir Keir Starmer has landed in Shanghai after meeting President Xi yesterday. Our political editor Chris Mason is travelling with the Prime Minister.
As Downing Street leaves the door open for a return trip to the UK for President Xi, more than a decade on from his four-day state visit in 2015, the perhaps near-inevitable commentary from the White House on the Prime Minister's journey east. Donald Trump, attending the premiere of the documentary film Melania about his wife, was asked this.
Mr. President, what do you think about the UK getting into business with China? Keir Starmer was in Beijing.
Well, it's very dangerous for them to do that, and it's even more dangerous, I think, for Canada to get into business with China.
Earlier at the Bank of China in Beijing, Sir Keir Starmer told British and Chinese business leaders his meeting with President Xi was very warm, and he wants to build a mutual trust and respect, as he put it, between the UK and China. In response to President Trump's remarks, Downing Street indicated that Washington was aware of this trip and its objectives in advance.
Ukraine has had a quieter night after Donald Trump said President Putin had agreed not to bomb the country during a week-long spell of extremely cold weather. There's been no comment from the Kremlin. Abdujalil Abdurasulov sent this report from Kyiv.
It was a rare night without sirens in Kyiv and most other parts of Ukraine. Air raid alerts have gone off only in four regions that are close to the front line and border Russia. The fighting continues there. This pause of Russian strikes comes at a time when the temperature in some areas of Ukraine is forecast to drop to minus 30 degrees Celsius in the next few days. Thousands of people still have no heating at home in the Kyiv region after the latest Russian attack. Emergency power cuts are continuing across the country. Response teams are working round the clock to repair power facilities. But President Zelensky says this task is extremely challenging.
European Union foreign ministers have agreed to designate Iran's Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist organisation because of the country's violent attacks on protesters. The EU has also imposed sanctions on Iranian officials, including the Interior Minister and Prosecutor General. Venezuela's parliament has passed a new bill that will pave the way for more private investors in its oil industry. That was one of the key demands of the US after it seized the country's president, Nicolas Maduro, in a military raid and carried out strikes on the capital. The Trump administration has also eased sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry to allow new American investments. Two serving British Army officers are to face a court-martial in relation to the handling of the case of a sexual assault on a teenage soldier. Gunner Jaisley Beck, who was 19, killed herself at her barracks at Larkhill Camp in Wiltshire in December 2021, 5 months after she was assaulted by former battery sergeant Michael Webber. He was subsequently jailed. The Ministry of Defence said the two had been charged with offences relating to conduct prejudicial to good order and service discipline. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
Jaisley Beck's inquest last year heard the Army's handling of her complaint of sexual assault had played more than a minimal contributory part in her death. At the time, the Army said it was profoundly sorry for the failings identified at the inquest. The Service Prosecution Authority has now charged two officers who were in Jaisley Beck's chain of command when she first reported the sexual assault. The BBC's been told they're Major James Hook and Colonel Samantha Shepherd. They were both made aware of her complaint before she took her own life.
Police investigating a 20,000-ton illegal waste site in Kidlington in Oxfordshire have arrested two men. Officers carried out raids in Andover in Hampshire and Slough in Berkshire. The Environment Agency said the men, aged 68 and 54, were detained on suspicion of environmental and money laundering offences. Both have been released on conditional bail. Our Rural Affairs correspondent Jenny Kumar reports.
The Environment Agency says the arrests are a vital step in ongoing investigations. It has been criticised for not doing enough soon enough to tackle the Kidlington dump. Reports of lorries tipping shredded domestic and commercial waste were first made last June. In October, a court approved an order restricting access to the site. The Environment Agency has no legal obligation to clear a dump, but it's taken the exceptional decision to do so in Kidlington because of the fire risk. The clean-up will cost around £10 million.
A public spending watchdog says the Ministry of Defence has recovered less than half the money it spent on detecting and tackling fraud and theft during the past 4 years. Many cases of fraud relate to pay and expenses, but in 2024 there were more than 2,000 reports of stolen assets. The MOD said it had zero tolerance for fraud and corruption. The first ever Deputy First Minister of Scotland, Lord Wallace, has died. He was 71 and had suffered complications as a result of surgery. As Scottish Liberal Democrat leader, Jim Wallace campaigned for devolution and his party described him as one of the architects of modern Scotland.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. More from you throughout the programme. It is 7 minutes past six. Let's say good morning for the first time this morning to Simon King, who's got the weather. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Emil. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. It's a rather damp start today across many parts of the UK. We've had some overnight rain moving its way north and eastward. It means that for parts of Wales, southwest and southeast England, it's a little bit drier this morning. Still some areas of rain, some drizzle, I think for some, but it is going to gradually work its way further north and eastward, so it will turn a bit drier. There may even be a few breaks in the cloud towards south Wales into the southeast of England, but those will be really quite limited before the next area of rain spreads in from the southwest, and that will move northeastward through the afternoon, turning quite heavy. It may not reach North Wales and the London, the southeast area until later in the day, temperatures of 7 to 11 degrees. For the Midlands, eastern England, northwest and northeast England, again, it's pretty wet this morning. Some rain, some drizzle to start off with. That rain is going to move its way gradually north and east with some clearer spells across the Midlands and eastern England, eventually northwest England as well. Very limited bright spells, temperatures of 6 to 10 Celsius. For Northern Ireland, rain this morning, gradually easing off, mostly drier this afternoon, still lots of cloud and one or two showers, temperatures of 8 or 9 Celsius. And finally, for Scotland today, we've got some winter showers coming into eastern Scotland, but otherwise it's a dry and chilly start to our Friday morning. Rain and hill snow, though, will gradually spread in across southern and central areas of Scotland today. The driest place with some bright spells will be in the northwest, and temperatures across Scotland, about 2 to 6 Celsius.
The morning's papers and Sir Keir Starmer's visit to China features prominently on the front pages, as you might expect. The Financial Times says the Prime Minister's been working to heal the ties between the countries. The Times says Sir Keir's vowed to build a more sophisticated relationship with China. The Daily Mirror says closer ties with Beijing could reap trade benefits for Britain at a time when the government needs to get the economy firing. The Guardian says the reset in the relationship has opened the door to a visit to the UK by President Xi. The Daily Mail has a more critical analysis of the visit, saying Sir Kowtow Starmer announced deals so underwhelming, critics responded, is that it?
The Times believes Britain is to follow the EU in proscribing Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRG, as a terrorist organisation. The paper says ministers will act as pressure grows to respond to the group's bloody suppression of anti-government protests.
The I paper leads with a suggestion that the UK is to deport asylum seekers to Syria in a crackdown on migrants. The paper says the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, is seeking to tackle the small boats crisis and the rise of Reform UK.
The I paper leads... The Daily Telegraph says the government's plan to cancel local elections for 4.5 million people is descending into farce as a string of councillors have resigned over the delays. The paper says that several councillors across the country are considering whether to stand down to force by-elections. Labour is allowing some councils to delay the ballots because of plans to reorganise local government.
The Telegraph this morning says the much-anticipated exhibition of the historic Bayeux Tapestry at the British Museum later this year could be scuppered by potholes. It says that French heritage campaigners have warned that the vibrations caused by potholes, both in Britain and in France, could rip apart the nearly 1,000-year-old embroidered cloth. That is one in the eye for history fans, suggests the Daily Express.
The Sun notes that while most adults spend around £2,000 on an engagement... £2,000 on an engagement ring, goodness. In the run-up to Valentine's Day, Asda is selling one for 96 pence. Yes, less, it points out, than the cost of a cucumber. Will you marry mean? Is its headline. I think £2,000 is quite a lot for a...
It is quite a lot. Although we don't sound very romantic having this conversation, do we?
Sorry. We presented together on Valentine's
Day. Money, no objects.
Time now is 11 minutes past six.
Let's talk about China. The Prime Minister's travelling to Shanghai as he continues his trip there. He has said that relations are in a good, strong place. But when President Trump was asked about the visit in the last few hours, he said it was very dangerous when asked about the UK increasing business ties with China. Laura Bicker, our China correspondent, is with us. That is an interesting perspective, Laura. You also talked about Canada as well. It's unsurprising that he might take exception to seeing relations deepening between the UK and China.
Well, Donald Trump threatened Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister, with tariffs after he announced this new strategic partnership with China. I think when it comes to the difference between the Canadian Prime Minister and the British Prime Minister, Mark Carney went much further while he was here. He talked about a changing world order in a press conference in the middle of a park in Beijing. Mr. Starmer has not gone as far as that. And I think when it comes to what the Chinese view of this will be, it goes back to perhaps Mr. Xi's quote yesterday, the Chinese proverb that he used. It was actually a Mao Zedong poem that he used, and the line was, range far your eye over long distances, i.e. one should take a long-term view. What President Xi is saying to not just Mark Carney but Sir Keir Starmer, he's saying, I will be here long after Donald Trump has left office.
And Laura, aside from the warm words, what has been achieved, signed off in terms of details and concrete things that both sides might have come away with?
So the visa-free travel is been the big headline. Tourists will get 30 days visa-free travel if you're a British passport holder. Actually, when it comes to that, Britain has been the outlier. There are over 70 countries that China's awarded this to in the last couple of years. And as Brits, we've been sitting wondering when a UK turn would come. And it did need this kind of leader-to-leader exchange for that to happen. We've seen announcements on AstraZeneca, the British pharmaceutical giant. They're going to invest $15 billion $1 billion in manufacturing and research and development. In fact, we've had more on that this morning. It looks like AstraZeneca are going to start researching weight loss drugs here in China. And then there was the cut on tariffs on Scotch whisky. That's going to be halved from 10% to 5%. I think I'm going to be honest with you here and say we did expect more. We had heard rumours of more. But when I've spoken to businesses here, British businesses here, they've told us that this kind of visit does smooth the path for further negotiations in the future.
Laura Bicker, our China correspondent, thank you.
It's 14 minutes past six. Attacks on Ukraine have reduced sharply in intensity after Donald Trump urged President Putin not to bomb the country during the extreme cold. Sarah Rainsford is our Eastern Europe correspondent and is in Dnipro right now. Sarah, just take us through what President Trump said, what it's got to do with the weather, and then what's changed in Ukraine in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, this is... There was a bit of a surprise announcement from Donald Trump as far as Ukraine was concerned. Certainly, there had been some discussion at the peace negotiations last week in Abu Dhabi about whether there could be what's described as an energy truce, so a halt to Russian strikes on civilian infrastructure, energy infrastructure here in Ukraine, and an equivalent Ukrainian halt to strikes on oil refineries in Russia. There hadn't been any agreement as far as we knew, but then Donald Trump came out and said that he had personally called Vladimir Putin and he'd asked him not to strike on Kyiv and other big cities for a week, as he said, during what he described as horrendously cold weather. Now, to put that in context, we're talking about temperatures this weekend, which are expected to head right back down to around about minus 20 degrees, which is horrifically cold when you're out and about on the streets. This is the kind of weather that makes your nasal hair freeze when you breathe. It is really horrible. And of course, that is weather that is now inside many Ukrainians' homes, because without power, without electricity, without any means of keeping warm inside, people have been freezing in their homes, and those attacks have been deliberate and targeted. So any kind of relief from that sort of devastating attack is obviously good for Ukrainians, and people here welcome it. And certainly we understand from the Ukrainian side that they do appear to be agreeing to mirror whatever Moscow does. I think there's a bit of skepticism. People, don't really trust Vladimir Putin to keep his word. But so far overnight, I can say that in Odessa, it was quiet. Here in Dnipro, there were just a few drones and there were no major missile attacks on Kyiv, which I think is a huge relief, because people had been braced for another massive attack. They were expecting Russia to carry out another big attack specifically targeting energy, which, as I say, is having really, really serious effects.
Sarah Rainsford in a very cold Dnipro. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's 17 minutes past six. Beijing will halve tariffs on Scottish whisky in a new measure announced as part of the Prime Minister's three-day visit to China. Felicity Hannah's got more on that and the rest of today's business news as well. Morning.
Morning. Yes, that's right. Following talks with President Xi Jinping, Keir Starmer announced the tariff cut from 10% to 5% for the industry, which he called the jewel in Scotland's crown. The government says this deal could be worth £250 million to the UK's economy over the next 5 years. Well, let's speak to William Weems, Managing Director of Weems Family Spirits. William, good morning.
Good morning.
What are you hoping?
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us. What are you hoping this deal will mean for you?
Well, we're hoping it will help us grow, regrow, in fact, our Scotch whisky exports into China. But hopefully the tariff cut will come with a return in consumer confidence in China, because that's an important part of the recovery for our brands in China.
Because you have seen sales fall in China. And if you look overall at the data from the Scotch Whisky Association, the US, in fact, is the number one destination for whisky exports. China is 10th. Do you think that this tariff reduction will really make a difference to you?
Well, I think any tariff reduction is, of course, welcome. The US tariffs remain a challenge. And as you point out, it is the single biggest market for Scotch whisky globally. So whilst China's welcome, we would prefer to see a cut in tariffs in the US, because it's a bigger and more important market.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? Because you've got 10% tariffs on exports to the US. And then comments from Donald Trump overnight saying it's very dangerous, in his words, for the UK to make deals with China. We know he's threatened Canada with tariffs if it goes through with new economic deals with China. How worried are you that today's good news might potentially create problems for that US market?
Well, we have seen no stability with President Trump. So we are ready for more tariffs if he decides to impose them, but we'll just have to wait and see. The industry is a long-term industry. We're distilling today for whiskey that we might sell in 15 or 21 years' time. So we need to plan ahead.
That's a very difficult thing to plan, isn't it? A very, very long-term view. Talk to me about the Chinese market then. How much do you currently export there and what are you hoping?
Well, we are hoping, as you mentioned, it was about 30% of our sales. It's fallen by up to two-thirds, but that's not really, I don't believe, a function of the tariff historically. It's more a function just of a weakening consumer confidence in China.
And what makes you think that will change?
Well, I'm not sure when it will change. I'm not sort of an economic voyeur, so we'll just have to wait and see. But these things are cyclical. The Chinese economy, I'm sure, the confidence will return. It's still growing healthily and more than the British economy. So I'm sure it will return. It's just a matter of time and when this will happen. And hopefully the Chinese consumer will begin to repurchase expensive Scotch whiskies.
I suppose you have to have a lot of optimism for the future when you're making a product today that won't come to market for 15 years.
Yes, well, we're Scottish. We're optimistic people. We know it'll come back. It's just a question of timing, really.
William Weems, Managing Director of Weems Family Spirits. Thank you very much indeed. Now, Apple saw a record $144 billion in sales for the final quarter of 2025, largely driven by stronger than expected demand for iPhones and a rebound in the Chinese market. Anna McDonald is investment manager at Aubrey. Anna, good morning. Really positive results for Apple. Revenues up 16%, but parts of the business didn't do as well, did they? Mac computer sales were down more than 7%.
Yes, that's true. And it is. It has several products in its stable. I think broadly investors will be relatively pleased. The overall revenue growth was well ahead of analyst expectations and a really strong rebound in China with sales up 38%.
OK, yes. And demand for iPhones being the key driver
of that. The iPhone 17 has been a very big success story.
And yet wearables, things like Apple Watches, they dipped below expectations. Does that suggest that Apple should be sticking to the basics?
I think that wearables probably have a considerable amount of competition. I think where investors are really wondering about what Apple's going to do next is on AI, because they have hung back more than some of the other big tech names in their investments within AI. So I think that's probably where we're going to see investor attention focus.
And it's quite interesting because the chief executive, Tim Cook, didn't give any detail when asked about that recently announced partnership with Google's AI product. So Apple very much approaching this differently to the other big tech firms we've seen reporting results this week.
Yes, I think actually there's something to be said to the fact that Apple products, and I mean, even the experience of opening an Apple, unboxing an iPhone when you buy it from after you've bought it, it's all meant to be a very sort of pleasurable and pretty perfect experience. And I think the stumbling that we're seeing, you know, not all the responses you get when you put something into ChatGPT are accurate. It's quite sort of un-Apple-y, if you see what I mean. And so I think they're being quite cautious in how they want to roll out AI.
And investors are being a little bit cautious when it comes to Microsoft, aren't they? Are quite worried, actually, because we've had all the hype and excitement around AI, all the big investments announced this week. But Microsoft's shares fell by around 10% after its earnings report on Thursday, which showed record profits, record revenues, but that big jump in AI spending.
Yes, and it's the jump in AI spending is one of the concerns, because you have investors starting to think about when are we going to see returns on these significant investments that Microsoft and others are making. But I think it's also important to step back and look at the broader software sector. It has really been struggling against the semiconductor sector. Software names, even other big ones, are down very sharply. And that's because I think there's a worry that you know, there are going to be AI developed tools that are highly capable of developing their own software. Now, I'm not saying that something can come and replace Microsoft. There's no chance of that. Mm. But what I'm saying is that investors seem to be running to escape from some of their software holdings. And despite the fact we're not seeing downgrades, we're actually seeing pretty good results. Some investors are running scared.
I wonder what investors will make of President Donald Trump confirming he's going to announce who will replace the Federal Reserve Chair, Jerome Powell, later today. Jerome Powell's term expires in May. And of course, there's that long-running row between the president and the head of the US Central Bank over interest rates. The president would like them to be cut faster. Do we know anything more about who might replace him?
The markets seem to be pretty sure it's going to be Kevin Warsh. He has been one of the governors of the Fed since 2006, and he actually interviewed for the role back when Trump was appointing Powell. So he seems to be the most likely. Mm. He's actually got a history of being fairly hawkish, i.e. that he tends to be more cautious about cutting rates. So that might be taken quite well by the markets in terms of being a sort of grown-up choice. What we have seen is a retreat this morning from what had been called safe haven, but had become quite speculative assets such as gold and silver. They're down quite sharply from where they were yesterday. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, I don't know. Kevin Warsh has been a little bit more pro interest rate cuts recently, but I think just his history is making investors think that perhaps this is a slightly more sensible choice than some of the others.
One to watch. Anna McDonald from Aubrey, thank you very much indeed. Now, what company might make your next passport? De La Rue, the British firm of secure printers who make the Bank of England's banknotes, says it has formed a 50-50 joint venture with Canada's Canadian Banknote Company to bid for the next UK passport contract. That contract is reported to be worth around £360 million. Now, at the moment, British passports are manufactured overseas in Poland under a deal held by Thales, the French multinational. So let's talk to Clive Vacher, who's De La Rue's CEO and joins me now. Clive, morning. You lost the contract to make UK passports back in 2020. You frankly admitted the company was struggling then. So what's different now?
Yes, good morning, Felicity.
Morning.
So the passport loss that we had in 2017, 2018 timeframe was purely a factor of price. And essentially the error that we made at that time was we overspecified the book itself. We made the most secure and most technologically advanced offering at that time. Now, obviously, since then, technology has moved on. We can produce a much more secure product at a much lower price. And so this time around, we are going to adjust that one piece of the actual cost of the passports themselves.
Okay.
And we believe with that we'll have a winning proposition.
So what would your bid involve then? What would your Canadian banknote company partner bring to the table that you can't do on your own?
Well, because we had actually exited the passport business shortly after we lost the British passport bid last time, what Canadian Banknote has been doing, it's one of the world's leading manufacturer of passports. It's got an extreme capability in terms of both digital and physical and the boundary between the two, because of course these passports are not just physical products, they have a whole digital backbone.
Yes.
So the Canadians will bring that technologically expertise and we will bring our design and manufacturing expertise to this venture. So it's a real match made in heaven.
And briefly, if you can, what would that mean for UK jobs if you were successful? What UK jobs? How many?
Well, the good thing about this is the passport's only the beginning. The UK passport's only the beginning. So our vision is to create hundreds of jobs, and the passport program itself will require tens of millions of investment within the UK in high-quality jobs. These are design jobs, digital jobs, technology and innovation jobs, and manufacturing jobs. So it's real investment in the future of UK manufacturing.
Clive Vacher, CEO of De La Rue, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Felicity. It's 28 minutes past six. It's time for the sport. Mike's here. Morning.
Hello, Anna. Shall we start in Melbourne? The world number one, Carlos Alcaraz, is bidding to reach his first ever Australian Open final. He's taking on the world number three, Alex Zverev, in the semi-finals. And we can head live to the Rod Laver Arena now for an update from tennis correspondent Russell Fuller.
And within the last 5 minutes or so, Mike, this match has potentially taken a very different turn. The scoreboard is very positive for the world number one, Carlos Alcaraz. He's taken the first set 6-4. He recovered from 5-2 down in the second set to win it on a tiebreak by 7-5 against Alex Zverev. The third set's going with serve. Alcaraz leads by 5-4. But in that previous game, he suddenly started feeling his right groin, stretching that leg out and moving at a much slower pace, playing drop shots even more regularly than he usually does, somehow getting through his service game, and he's now having a medical timeout at the change of ends. He is one game from victory, but his movement seems to be limited. Zverev is furious that he's been allowed a medical timeout. He was chatting to the German supervisor who came onto the court. Chatting is too gentle a word. He was telling him in no uncertain terms that it was unbelievable that Alcaraz was getting a medical timeout. Zverev clearly thinks he's cramping, in which case a medical timeout would not be permitted. But the medical team have decided it's an injury, hence the medical timeout, and they're about to resume with Alcaraz. One game, but seemingly very, very far away from the semi, from the final.
Worrying time, seemingly, for Carlos Alcaraz. We'll keep an eye on that. You can follow it right now on Five Sports Extra and BBC Sounds. Later in Melbourne, Jannik Sinner is in action in the second semi-final against 10-time winner Novak Djokovic. And again, you can hear that on BBC Sounds. Next to the Europa League, and a good night for Celtic last night, who have made it through to the playoff round. They beat Utrecht by 4-2 in Glasgow. Kenny Crawford was watching.
It's been a bizarre and often frustrating season for Celtic, but this was a peak rather than a trough as Martin O'Neill's men made sure of European football beyond January. It looked like it was going to be easy. Benjamin Negrin's 14th of the season, then an own goal, and Arne Engel's penalty put Celtic 3-0 up after just 20 minutes. But Danny De Vit and Englishman Adrian Blake scored really well taken strikes to bring the Dutch side back into it before Austin Trusty's glancing header sealed the deal for the hosts. Celtic will face either Stuttgart or Ferencváros in the playoff round.
And just briefly, in the Europa League elsewhere last night, already qualified Aston Villa finished second in the league phase after coming from behind to beat Red Bull Salzburg 3-2. Nottingham Forest, who'd also already booked a playoff place, comfortably beat the Hungarians Ferencváros 4-0. Rangers were already out. Their campaign ended in a 3-1 defeat to Porto.
Big drama down under, Mike. Thank you very much indeed. Tomorrow, Radio 4 welcomes the return of this man.
I'm Greg James, and I'm back with a new series of Rewinder. Each week, the stories in the headlines open the door to the BBC archives.
You don't think you've annoyed the public without, in fact, achieving anything?
Oh, no, not at all.
Uncovering unexpected audio treasures from the past.
Well, like her owner, Dagwood just loves to play table tennis. And what's more, she's ambidextrous. All of which makes the table tennis tabby a very thirsty cat.
The new series of Rewinder, starting tomorrow morning at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan in London and Anna Foster in Salford. It's 28 minutes to 7. Tom Sanders has a summary of the news.
President Trump has said that it would be dangerous for the UK to do more business with China. The Prime Minister is currently in the country to strengthen economic ties with Beijing. In response to President Trump's remarks, Downing Street indicated that Washington was aware of this trip and its objectives in advance, and pointed out the President is due in China himself in April. Ukraine has had a quieter night after Mr. Trump said Vladimir Putin had agreed to pause airstrikes on cities and towns in the country for 1 week because of extremely low temperatures. Ukraine is suffering its harshest winter since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022. EU foreign ministers have agreed to proscribe Iran's Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist organisation in response to the violent suppression of protests. The EU has also imposed sanctions on Iranian officials. Europe's foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, said any regime that killed thousands of its own people was working towards its own demise. Two serving British Army officers will face a court-martial in relation to the handling of the case of sexual assault of a 19-year-old soldier. Jaisley Beck killed herself at Lark Hill Camp in Wiltshire in December 2021, 5 months after she was assaulted by former battery sergeant Michael Webber. He was subsequently jailed. Police have arrested two men in connection with a 20,000-ton illegal waste site in Kidlington in Oxfordshire. The Environment Agency said the men, aged 68 and 54, were detained on suspicion of environmental and money laundering offences and had been released on conditional bail. The government says it will extend the Warm Home Discount scheme until the end of the decade. It means millions of families in England and Wales will continue to receive a yearly discount of £150. Scotland's first ever Deputy First Minister, Lord Wallace, has died aged 71. He led the Scottish Lib Dems, who described him as one of the architects of modern Scotland because of his campaigning for devolution.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It is 26 minutes to 7. What is America planning when it comes to Iran? There has been this major military build-up. President Trump has referred to it as an armada. It's happening in the Arabian Sea and the Gulf of, the Gulf of Oman, which separates Bahrain and Oman to the south from Iran in the north. Meanwhile, plenty of diplomacy is ongoing to try to diffuse tensions. James Landau is our diplomatic correspondent. James, just tell us what America has done and then we'll get to the diplomacy and whether or not it's working.
Well, the threat of an attack remains. The US has built up, as you say, a substantial military presence in the region. About 10 warships, a full carrier strike group. They need that because some of the Gulf countries have said that they're not prepared to allow their airspace to be used by the US to launch any attack. And overnight, Donald Trump said very explicitly, we have, and I'm quoting, a lot of very big, very powerful ships sailing to Iran right now. So the threat remains. But then he went on to add, quote, it would be great if we didn't have to use them. So that's the latest uttering that analysts and diplomats are trying to parse in the region.
And in terms of what the regional diplomats, Turkey, Saudi Arabia and others are doing, I know Iran's obviously a great ally of China, which will have views on what should happen next. What are diplomats trying to do to make sure that George Orwell rather than war prevails?
Well, desperate attempt to avoid head-off military action. From the Gulf, a lot of those countries, as I say, have made it very clear to the Americans that they do not support military action and that they won't allow their airspace to be used, in part because Iran has made it very clear that if there were any US attack, Iran would retaliate hard with its missiles against not just US targets, but also allied targets in the region. In terms of the focus of the diplomacy today, it's very much the ball is in Turkey's court. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, is in Turkey today for talks. The Turks have made it very clear that they want both sides to step back. President Erdogan of Turkey has offered to host some kind of talks between the Iranians and the US. Of course, the Americans and the Iranians do not talk directly to each other, so a lot of it has to be indirect. So, you know, conversations continue.
James Landau, our diplomatic correspondent, thank you.
It's 23 minutes to 7. On today's programme, we're giving a special focus to how children's use of social media and phones and screen time plays out actually inside our homes, because the start of 2026 has seen a social media ban for young people debated in Parliament here in the UK, in France, Austria, countries around the world. Australia has brought it's in already. But what can parents and carers actually do right now? We've had hundreds of messages from you about this week and about the conversations that you have to have with your children or your grandchildren, what limits or rules you might set, about the example that you try to give around your own phone use, which is always really tricky as well, isn't it? Zoe Kleinman, our technology editor, is with us. Morning, Zoe.
Morning.
So we talk a lot about laws and schools and that kind of thing, but actually when we're trying to deal with things at home and those direct conversations that we're having with our children, where is public opinion on things like that, on screen time and phones, and what we should be doing with it as a society?
It's certainly generating a lot of conversation, isn't it? There's some new research by Ipsos, which was carried out just last week. They spoke to over 1,000 adults in the UK, and they found that the majority of the public now supported a mobile phone ban in schools, and many have one already. But one in five still opposed it, which is interesting. People are still divided a little bit over this issue. The government has said, by the way, that it wants mobile phone policies to be included in Ofsted inspections of schools from now on. One in three adults thought 16 was the right age for social media. One in 10 thought children should never have it. But this still means that the majority sound like they're okay with the current minimum age, which is 13. But there's a government consultation going on about that too. And finally, most people who Ipsos spoke to said they thought protecting children under the age of 16 online was primarily the responsibility of parents and the social media companies. Now, legally, under the Online Safety Act, it's the responsibility of the companies themselves. But as we know, they lean rather heavily, don't they, on parental controls in their child safety toolkits.
Yeah, and also there was a report last week published by the government, Zoe, that you spotted. And it's about, again, this is right at the heart of this, how damaging excessive amounts of screen time and having phones available and all that sort of thing, how damaging that actually is to children. We don't really know.
So again, this is something that is debated in the scientific community, because some experts say there's actually a lack of quality evidence which really categorically links children's mental health and well-being to social media, phones and AI chatbots. And they say, you know, the evidence, there's a lot of anecdotal data, isn't there? We've all got stories to tell, but the actual evidence doesn't yet, you know, absolutely definitively suggest that it is harming children.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting element. Zoe, thank you. Zoe Kleinman there, our technology editor. We're going to devote the last half hour of the programme today to this topic. So from 8:30, we'll talk about how you manage your children's social media screen time habits. We're going to make it useful for you as well. Some solutions in there, the kind of thing that is actually helpful on what is a really tricky topic. So do get in touch. Tell us what you do at home, what you've tried, what works, what doesn't work. You can send us a message or a voice note on the Today programme WhatsApp number, which is 03 30 123 4346. That's 03 30 123 4346. Or you can send us an email, as always, to today@bbc.co.uk.
Let's get into the politics of it, because it's interesting, isn't it? Let's talk to Harry Farley, our political correspondent. Harry, it's interesting. There was a quite a significant move by Kemi Badenoch a few weeks ago, to which Andy Burnham responded by saying, well, actually, he found himself agreeing with a lot of what Kemi Badenoch said on this. Do you feel this is a sort of coming issue in terms of parliamentary process?
Absolutely. The politics of this has really crystallised around the particular idea of a legal ban for social media for under 16s. As you say, Kemi Badenoch backs the idea. That idea has gained momentum, and perhaps, I suppose, more worryingly for the government, or more concerning for them, is that so did 61 Labour MPs, signing a letter calling on the government to introduce that legal minimum age of 16 for social media. And when you talk about parliamentary process, you're right, because there is an amendment coming back to the Commons, and there will be a vote that would bring this into law, that would enact that ban on under 16s having access to social media. The government's response is to say we'll launch a consultation. But from speaking to people in government this morning, they are clear. They understand the strength of feeling about this. They're saying they will take action on children and screen time, but they want to consult and to understand the evidence before deciding what that approach should be. But from speaking to those Labour MPs in particular, they're clear on what they believe the approach should be, and they are clear they want a legal ban on social media for under 16s. They're not willing to back the government in voting against that when it comes to the Commons in a few weeks' time. And so it does look like that vote could be a particular flashpoint in the politics of this debate, at least.
And meanwhile, we should talk about China, Harry. What's the sort of Labour MP reaction to whether or not Keir Starmer has done well in China?
The sense I get from speaking to many Labour MPs is that, to be honest, they're slightly indifferent to the Prime Minister's trip. The Conservatives and Reform, much more critical, arguing that China can't be trusted. But there isn't a great swell of opposition from Labour MPs, at least. neither, frankly, were many hugely excited about some of the deals the government announced on visa-free travel or cuts in whiskey tariffs. But that interest and that potential opposition might change if the prospect of President Xi visiting the UK becomes a reality. Right. Downing Street leaving the door open to that. And a few Labour MPs were texting last night concerned about that, given the ongoing imprisonment of Jimmy Lai.
Harry Farley, our political correspondent, thank you.
Stay in Westminster because the government again rejected claims for compensation from women born in the 1950s yesterday in Parliament. The group's known as the Waspy Women, and they say that they were not properly warned about a rise in the state pension age. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
The Work and Pensions Secretary's announcement didn't go down well in the Commons.
I must say that this is a disappointing statement.
People recognise that there is a real sense of injustice that has been done to those women.
The Secretary of State knows just how disappointing so many will find this statement.
The problem for Pat McFadden was that all those complaints came from Labour MPs. Campaigners say 3.6 million women weren't properly informed about the rise in their state pension age. The government had previously rejected their claim for compensation, but in the autumn, ministers decided to reconsider the decision after receiving additional information. Announcing the result of that review, the Work and Pensions Secretary accepted that letters about the change could have been sent earlier.
And I am sorry that those letters were not sent sooner.
But having reviewed all the information, the government had come to the same conclusion and wouldn't be paying compensation. Pat McFadden said the vast majority of women knew about the age change.
To specifically compensate only those women who suffered injustice would require a scheme that could reliably verify the individual circumstances of millions of women. That includes whether someone genuinely didn't know their state pension age was changing, and whether they would have read and remembered a letter from many years ago and acted differently.
That, he argued, wouldn't be practical, and the alternative, to compensate all women in that age group, would cost more than £10 billion. The Conservative Shadow Work and Pensions Secretary, Mark Garnier, said that before the general election, senior Labour figures had backed the Waspy Women.
Is it no wonder, therefore, that the Waspy Women, who were promised so much, are so angry? The people who used to stand beside them have now turned against them. If the government really believed that these women had faced a great injustice, they would have found a way to compensate them.
Pat McFadden said Labour had campaigned against the decision to accelerate the increase in the state pension age taken under the coalition government. This ruling was about whether there should be compensation for the way that change was communicated. But the SNP's Kirsty Blackman persisted, repeating that Labour MPs had previously supported the Waspy Women's campaign for compensation.
The minister is standing there holding his hands up saying, I'm very sorry that the previous administration forgot to send out a letter, but we're not going to do anything about it because it wouldn't have made a difference anyway. Has he listened to the voices of Waspy Women who've come to every single one of us and said, I didn't get that letter. Yeah, yeah. I did not know that the state pension age was increasing.
The Work and Pensions Secretary stuck to his guns.
There was a wide range of communications about this. Letters are one part of that, but they're not the only part of that. And when you take into account the survey evidence as a whole, most people knew the state pension age was increasing.
For the Lib Dems, Steve Darling harked back to a recent conversation with Pat McFadden.
Where we reflected on him being a fan of Celtic and Bruce Springsteen, but I wasn't aware that he was also a member of the Magic Circle.
Steve Darling accused him of creating illusions, when really this was all about injustice.
There are more than 3.6 million Waspy women across the UK who will feel this as if it were a punch in the stomach. Mm-hmm. They will feel utterly betrayed, and they will feel betrayed because false hope was given to them in the autumn, and so that hope has been dashed.
Pat McFadden repeated that the decision to raise the women's state pension age had been taken when the Lib Dems were in power, and he stressed things would be different in the future, so that
we not only consider policy but fully consider all the aspects of communication and the period of warning. Things that were distinctly not done when that decision to accelerate the state pension age happened under his government in the coalition.
But Pat McFadden's answers didn't placate Labour MPs sitting on the benches behind him, including Melanie Onn.
Why does he think that these women should accept this outcome? And why does he think it always is women who seem to get such a rough end of the deal?
But Pat McFadden insisted compensating women who knew about the change wouldn't be right or fair.
That's Alicia McCarthy reporting. It's 12 minutes to 7.
Private landlords will be given until 2035 to meet a new set of standards called the Decent Homes Standards. This marks a shift in minimum housing requirements for private landlords, which is already in place for social housing, but will be extended to the private rented sector under something called the Renters' Rights Act, quite a big part of the government's plans in terms of domestic reform. Housing campaigners have pushed for a deadline of 2030, but the government says that both social and private landlords will in fact have until 2035. So potentially after a couple of general elections, to comply with robust standards to combat issues like damp, leaks and disrepair and energy insufficiency. This is a subject of huge interest, of course, particularly to younger listeners and younger would-be renters, because many of them can't afford to live in a house that they own. Ben Toomey is the Chief Executive of Generation Rent, and Chris Norris is the Chief Policy Officer at the National Residential Landlords Association. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
So, Ben, you took part in the government's consultation. What do you make of where they've ended up?
Well, it's very disappointing to find that there's a complete lack of urgency to just bring up to the basic standards what our homes are. It's absurd to let landlords drag their feet for an entire decade when all we're asking for is effectively action to take care of disrepair, effectively insulated or heated homes, and the most dangerous hazards being really clear for renters what they can do to be able to make sure that councils are addressing those things.
Chris, absurd to let landlords drag their feet for a decade?
I agree that we really do need some clarity. I mean, Ben's right that the system at the moment does mean that it's unclear for landlords. It's also really unclear for tenants about the standards they've got to meet. But I would kind of correct on one thing. You said there that this was a new standard for private landlords and that social landlords already had the system in place. This is a completely new decent home standard for both sectors. And I think that's actually why the government has set this timetable. They seem to believe that social landlords in particular need a longer time period to get ready for these new standards without diverting away from delivery of new homes. But it should be pointed out, for private landlords at least, I can't speak for social landlords, but for private landlords at least, all of these standards are already in place. You know, the housing, health and safety rating system already means that we should be delivering, you know, high quality, safe homes. The EPC requirements, the energy efficiency requirements are already there. I think what we really need to do is just bring it all together under one label, and that will be helpful.
But so, Chris, is the implication of what you... Thank you for the corrective, appreciate it. But is the implication of what you say that actually this won't change very much for landlords?
I think it'll simplify things for landlords and tenants. I mean, at the moment, we have this slightly crazy mismatch of 40 or 50 years worth of regulations that all have slightly different components. And the Decent Home Standard, what I think will be positive is it brings it together under these five core pillars that landlords and tenants can understand. But to be quite candid, no, that the standard that sits beneath it isn't really changing a great deal. That the bit that is changing is energy efficiency. And that's already programmed to come in 2030. So that will be there slightly earlier. Even the sanctions that are changing with the Decent Home Standard are coming into force later this year, the sanctions that mean that landlords really do have to act and can be enforced against if they've got serious hazards in their property. That's coming in this year, or it's being modified this year. So, no, most of the standards for private landlords, at least, are already there.
OK, Ben, what would you say to that idea that actually the issue is not kind of you don't need a new set of rules, you just need the current rules to be better enforced?
I think that's a really important point, to basically say that renters find it really difficult to understand what their rights are, where their rights do exist. And they're spread across a whole range of different types of legislation. You know, who's going to know what's in Part 1 of the Housing Act 2004 or what's in the health and safety standards for rented homes? The thing about the Decent Home Standard is it brings it all together and it makes it a lot clearer for people. But also there are new standards in there that will be important to be enforced. The way the government's dealt with this is to take a range of things that that landlords should already be doing, as well as a few new things that would make sure that our homes aren't so rotten and in such a state of disrepair, or have, you know, core facilities that basically means you have got a bathroom or a kitchen that's not, you know, down the end of the garden. All these things are pretty simple, but it's kicked it into the long grass so far that you've got two general elections happening before we even get there. So they've got no control whatsoever over whether the standards come into force. It should be very straightforward, and we're really in quite some disbelief that they haven't got a grip of it.
Do you feel that basically they've fudged it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really strange position to be in, where the Labour manifesto promised voters they'd take steps to decisively raise standards. This isn't taking steps. This is crawling towards some sort of hopeful improvement for renters in the future.
We'll try and put both your points of view towards the Labour ministers that are relevant when we get the chance. Ben Toomey from Generation Rent and Chris Norris, Chief Policy Officer at the National Residential Landlords Association. Thank you.
It's 7 minutes to seven. We've been speaking to the main parties in Wales this week ahead of the Senedd elections. The traditionally strong performance of Welsh Labour will be looked at very carefully as challenger parties look to increase their MS share. Let's talk to Jane Dodds, who's leader of the Welsh Liberal Democrats. Good morning.
Good morning, Bore da.
Bore da, when we talk about those challenger parties, the big names, and if we look at the Caerphilly by-election, for example, the big names at the moment seem to be Plaid Cymru, Reform UK. Nobody's really mentioning the Lib Dems. What are you offering that is distinctive and different and would make people in Wales vote for you?
Well, firstly, we want to see a different sort of politics where the progressive parties work together on an agenda and the common ground that we have. And I've delivered on that in my time in the Senedd. So the Welsh Liberal Democrats are ambitious for Wales. We want to address the social care system, which is in crisis at the moment here. We want to provide free childcare for children aged between 9 months and 4 years. That will help tackle child poverty and get parents into work. We want to clean up our rivers and our beaches and support our small businesses to grow. And this is really important, this final point, in the context we're in here in Wales. Just as the Liberal Democrats wanted to remain in the European Union and we want to rejoin the European Union, the Welsh Liberal Democrats want to remain in the United Kingdom. We work better together. We are better as a family of nations and we can achieve more. And so the Welsh Liberal Democrats want to ensure that we fight any options and any agenda around independence. We will stop independence, which is what Plaid Cymru and the Green Party want.
Are those messages getting through, though? Because if we look at the by-election in Caerphilly, the Lib Dems only got 1.5% of the vote. You were equal with the Greens. You were below the Conservatives, right down there. And you talked about painting Wales Lib Dem gold, but that seems a little overconfident, doesn't it?
Well, look, by-elections are very different. And we know that the focus on the by-election in Caerphilly was very different. And it was under a very different system. It was still under the first-past-the-post system. And we've got a different system here in Wales. And nobody knows what's going to happen because we've never had an election like this. And actually, if you look back to July 2024 for the Westminster election, the polls predicted the Liberal Democrats would deliver 30 MPs and we delivered 73. Look, I'm under no illusion. I'm not going to be the next First Minister of Wales. And my party is probably going to not be the majority in a government here in Wales. But we will play a role, I'm sure. And our role is to stop independence and to protect the NHS.
How is your relationship with the Lib Dem leader, Ed Davey, now? Because it's been strained.
Well, firstly, I want to say I'm focused on delivering for the people of Wales. And I've said all that there is to say on this. I've given a very extensive interview to the BBC. And I don't know what else I can say. I've been very honest and upfront in this. And as I say,
I was just wondering how the relationship was, because you talked about trying to improve it and you don't have his full confidence. And I was just wondering how things were now.
Well, nothing has changed, and I'm focused on what we have ahead of us in the election. You know, the ambition that we have here for the Liberal Democrats is clear. Right now, there are 700,000 people in Wales on waiting lists. There are 1,400 people in hospitals waiting for social care. Child poverty in Wales is at 31%, and there's a town in Mid Wales where there is no NHS dentist and a population of 6,000. That's my focus, and that's my ambition.
Jane Dodds, thank you for joining us, the leader of the Liberal Democrats in Wales. As I said, we're hearing from all of the main parties on the programme this week. You'll have heard Justin brought the programme to you from Cardiff on Wednesday after 7 o'clock this morning. We're going to hear from Reform UK in Wales as well.
Tell us, sweetheart, who was it? Who did this to you?
Arrived late to Ambridge. Did you know that most smart speakers can start the programme again? Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart and listen from the beginning.
Here, are you ready? Grandma and Grandpa are waiting for us. We need to leave.
Try it for yourself. Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart.
It's 3 minutes to seven. Here's Simon King with the weather.
Amol, thanks so much indeed. Good morning, everybody. It's remaining pretty unsettled over the next few days. There is further rain in the forecast. And for some fairly high rainfall totals, especially across eastern areas of Scotland. So there could still be some flooding issues with this further rain. But it's a rather chilly start to the day across many areas. So for Wales, southwest and southeast England, it's also pretty damp with that chilly weather. We've got that rain, that drizzle, which is going to move its way a bit further north and eastward. It will clear. There may be a few breaks in the cloud across parts of South Wales into the West Country, but those will be very limited before further rain moves in from the southwest and spreads northeastward throughout the afternoon. The rain may not reach North Wales and the London, the southeast area, really until right at the end of the day, and maximum temperatures getting up to about 7 to 11 degrees. Now for the Midlands, eastern England, northwest and northeast England, again, it's also pretty wet this morning. Some outbreaks of rain, which is going to continue to move north and eastward. It will gradually clear from the Midlands and eastern England. There'll be a few limited bright spells developing here into the afternoon. The rain also eventually clearing from northwest England, but staying quite damp in the northeast. Top temperatures of 6 to 10 Celsius. For Northern Ireland, we've got some rain this morning. That's going to gradually ease off and it'll become a little bit drier into the afternoon. Still quite a lot of cloud and some showery outbreaks of rain, temperatures of 8 or 9 Celsius. And for Scotland today, well, some winter showers coming into eastern Scotland this morning. Otherwise, though, it's a dry and chilly start to Friday. Rain will move its way gradually into southern and central areas of Scotland into this afternoon. Some hill snow developing here as well, but driest to the northwest of Scotland. Some bright or sunny spells and temperatures of 2 to 6 Celsius.
Simon, thank you. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Amol Rajan in London.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 30th of January. The headlines this morning, President Trump has warned the UK against boosting trade ties with Beijing during the Prime Minister's visit to China, describing it as very dangerous. There have been fewer Russian attacks against Ukraine overnight after Donald Trump said he'd urged Vladimir Putin to halt the missile attacks during extremely low temperatures. And two army officers are to face a court-martial over the way they handled a sexual assault case of a teenage soldier who killed herself.
We're doing something a little bit different on the programme this morning. We're taking a long, hard look at social media, phones and screen time, particularly as they relate to kids. We'll look at some of the key issues over the next 2 hours. And from 8:30, the whole programme will be dedicated to what we can do to make things better. Hundreds of you have been getting in touch with us all week to tell us your concerns.
We both kind of feel that phones have somewhat ruined our experience of parenting.
I too poisoned my relationship with my teenagers, trying to control their smartphone and social media use. But I think it is possible to put limits on it, but it takes really strong parenting to do it.
The social media ban is a starting point. Of course it can be circumvented, but it sends a clear message that we need to think about the use of digital media carefully.
And one of the key things we're going to focus on very explicitly is really possible, practical, plausible solutions.
The first principle, this is the one I wish I'd done, is no screens of any kind in bedrooms ever. This stuff is like a gas that expands to fill every moment. So if you have that rule, it won't fill every moment of your kid's day.
That was Professor Jonathan Haidt. And if all of that wasn't quite enough, we're also going to be celebrating the most successful scientific equation in history as quantum mechanics marks its 100th birthday. The BBC News is read this morning by Tom Sanders.
President Trump has claimed it would be dangerous for the UK to do more business with China as the Prime Minister works to strengthen economic ties with the country on the third day of his trip there. Mr. Trump's warning is similar in tone to the Conservatives, who've accused the Prime Minister of kowtowing to China. This morning, Sir Keir Starmer, who's insisted that he won't choose between Beijing and Washington, has arrived in Shanghai after meeting President Xi yesterday. Our political editor Chris Mason is travelling with the Prime Minister.
As Downing Street leaves the door open for a return trip to the UK for President Xi, more than a decade on from his four-day state visit in 2015, the perhaps near-inevitable commentary from the White House on the Prime Minister's journey east. Donald Trump, attending the premiere of the documentary film Melania about his wife, was asked this.
Mr. President, what do you think about the UK getting into business with China? Keir Starmer was in Beijing.
Well, it's very dangerous for them to do that, and it's even more dangerous, I think, for Canada to get into business with China.
Earlier at the Bank of China in Beijing, Sir Keir Starmer told British and Chinese business leaders his meeting with President Xi was very warm, and he wants to build a mutual trust and respect, as he put it, between the UK and China. His critics say the Chinese state simply cannot be trusted. In response to President Trump's remarks, Downing Street indicated that Washington was aware of this trip and its objectives in advance, and pointed out the president is due in China himself in April.
Ukraine has had a quieter night after Donald Trump said President Putin had agreed not to bomb the country during a week-long spell of extremely cold weather. There are warnings the harsh winter and the attacks on energy plants are leading to a humanitarian catastrophe. There's been no comment from the Kremlin. Abdul Jalil Abdurasalov sent this report from Kyiv.
Overnight, air raid alerts have gone off only in four regions of Ukraine that are close to the front line and border Russia. Ukraine's Air Force claims Moscow launched 80 drones and a ballistic missile as the fighting continues there. But areas away from the front line had a rare night without sirens. This pause of Russian strikes comes at a time when the temperature in some parts of Ukraine is forecast to drop to minus 30 degrees Celsius in the next few days. Thousands of people still have no heating at home in the Kyiv region following the latest Russian attack. Emergency power cuts are continuing across the country. Response teams are working round the clock to repair power facilities. But this task is extremely challenging.
President Trump has declared Cuba to be a threat to the national security of the United States and signed an executive order enabling trade tariffs to be imposed on any country that sells or provides oil to the Caribbean Islands nation. The order accuses Havana of supporting and assisting groups such as Hamas and Hezbollah and countries hostile to the US. Two serving British Army officers are to face a court-martial in relation to the handling of the case of a sexual assault of a teenage soldier. Gunner Jaisley Beck, who was 19, killed herself at her barracks at Larkhill Camp in Wiltshire in December 2021, 5 months after she was assaulted by former battery sergeant Michael Webber. He was subsequently jailed for 6 months for the attack. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
Jaisley Beck's inquest last year heard the Army's handling of her complaint of sexual assault had played more than a minimal contributory part in her death. At the time, the Army said it was profoundly sorry for the failings identified at the inquest. The Service Prosecution Authority has now charged two officers who were in Jaisley Beck's chain of command when she first reported the sexual assault. The BBC's been told their Major James Hook and Colonel Samantha Shepherd. They were both made aware of her complaint before she took her own life. In a statement, the Ministry of Defence confirmed that two individuals had been charged with offences under Section 19 of the Armed Forces Act, which relates to conduct prejudicial to good order and service discipline. In response, Jaisley's mother, Leanne McCready, said that more than 4 years after her death, her family were very relieved to have got to this point. She said it would not be appropriate to comment further.
Police investigating a 20,000-ton illegal waste site in Kidlington in Oxfordshire have arrested two men. Officers carried out raids in Andover in Hampshire and Slough in Berkshire. The Environment Agency said the men, aged 68 and 54, were detained on suspicion of environmental and money laundering offences. Both have been released on conditional bail. Our Rural Affairs correspondent Jenny Kumar reports.
The Environment Agency says the arrests are a vital step in ongoing investigations. It has been criticised for not doing enough soon enough to tackle the Kidlington dump. Reports of lorries tipping shredded domestic and commercial waste were first made last June. In October, a court approved an order restricting access to the site. The Environment Agency has no legal obligation to clear a dump, but it's taken the exceptional decision to do so in Kidlington because of the fire risk. The clean-up will cost around £10 million.
A public spending watchdog says the Ministry of Defence has recovered less than half the money it spent on detecting and tackling fraud and theft during the past 4 years. Many cases of fraud relate to pay and expenses, but in 2024 there were more than 2,000 reports of stolen assets, nearly a third of which were related to weapons, armour and communication systems. The MOD said it had zero tolerance for fraud and corruption and had put in place robust controls. Millions of families in England and Wales will receive £150 off their energy bills every year until the end of the decade under a government measure. Ministers have announced a five-year extension to the Warm Home Discount Scheme. Changes in Scotland will bring the rebate more into line with England and Wales, where most recipients receive it automatically. Specialist doctors have said more research is needed into whether a link exists between the use of weight loss injections and an increase in gallbladder removals. In 2024-25, just over 80,000 such operations were carried out by NHS England, up 15% on the previous year. Gallstones are listed as a common side effect of weight loss jabs. Manufacturers say the safety of patients are their top priority, and anyone experiencing side effects should talk to a healthcare professional. Dr. Ahmed Ahmed from the British Obesity and Metabolic Specialist Society says there needs to be an investigation into whether the jabs are linked to patients suffering gallbladder problems.
We asked them, you know, have you done anything recently, anything different? And interestingly, some of them do mention that they've been using weight loss injections. So there appears to be an association at least between using weight loss injections and developing gallstones. But clearly this area needs further research to find out if it's causative or not.
The theatre organist and broadcaster Nigel Ogden has died at the age of 71. He was the host of Radio 2's The Organist Entertains for 38 years until the show was stopped in 2018. Here he is introducing the programme, followed by the thoughts of one of his friends, Phil Kelsall, the organist at Blackpool Tower.
Hello again, Nigel Ogden here with this week's edition of The Organist Entertains.
Nigel was a unique type of character. He was certainly very friendly and he certainly lived for the organ music. He was on every week. He always ensured the standard was very high. You know, you had to be spot on or else he wouldn't get featured on the programme. It brought the organ to the general public.
Phil Kelsall reflecting on the organist and broadcaster Nigel Ogden, who's died.
Thank you, Tom. It is 7:10. It's very dangerous for the UK to increase its business relationship with China, so says President Trump, who was asked about Sir Keir Starmer's visit to Beijing just in the last few hours. The Prime Minister, who's been meeting Chinese trade leaders again this morning, has talked about warmly engaging and about making real progress. But is it inevitable that our long-standing relationship with one superpower might get a bit strained if we get close to another? Or can everything be balanced to keep everybody happy? Well, earlier today, the Prime Minister addressed attendees at the UK-China Business Forum and praised the progress he says has been made on the trip so far.
We've had key bilaterals yesterday with President Xi and also Premier Li. Very warm, very good meetings. Just the level of engagement that we hoped for on behalf of both of our countries to develop that comprehensive and strategic partnership that is both long-term and consistent.
Well, our political editor Chris Mason is travelling with the Prime Minister, is in China at the moment. Chris, we've heard all of those warm words, but it is a little bit of a fly in the ointment, is it not, that the US and President Trump in particular doesn't seem too keen with Sir Keir cozying up to President Xi?
Morning to you, Anna, from a chandelier-laden hotel reception in Shanghai, where the Prime Minister's landed in the last hour or so for the second leg of this Chinese tour, trying to deepen those connections, as you say. And I think those remarks from Donald Trump illustrate the tricky triangulation, if you like, that the Prime Minister is attempting in foreign affairs. Here is the UK as a kind of middle-ranking country, if you like, in terms of economic scale, to use the language of the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney in the last week or so, trying to strike relationships with big blocs or big countries, so whether that be China, the European Union or the United States, but doing so in a way where to lean in one direction
can lead to a pushback in the other. Now, speaking to those around the Prime Minister on the flight from Beijing in the last couple of hours, I think there's a sense that in the calibration of Donald Trump outbursts, this one is at the lower end of the rhetorical Richter scale. They were anticipating perhaps he would say something. They say that they had briefed Washington about what their intentions were on this trip. They make the argument that Donald Trump says that President Xi is a friend of his and that Donald Trump himself will be in here in China in the next couple of months. But yeah, I think it is an illustration of that noisy diplomatic world that the Prime Minister is forever treading a fine line along.
And if we pick it apart, Chris, we're hearing lots of positive things being said, but in terms of what's being announced, what's being signed, is that living up to expectation?
I think it's reasonable to say that there is a gap between the rhetoric and the warmth. I don't think it's too far to say a certain bonhomie, really, in terms of the tone and language being used by the Prime Minister and others on this trip. And if you like, at this stage, at least, what you might call the deliverables, the outcomes, the talk around visas, for instance, so being able to travel to China without a visa on a trip of under 30 days. No date for when that kicks in yet, but that is a deal that's been done. And the cut in whiskey tariffs from 10 to 5%. I think the way that those in government would see it is that this will be iterative. This will be one step at a time, and they hope that there'll be more to come. Their argument being that the relationship has been in something of the deep freeze for the last, or best part of the last decade, certainly the last 8 years. But they're keenly aware that there's a very stark political argument, isn't there, at home around whether or not this trip, full stop, let alone anything else around it, is a good idea and is in the UK national interest. The Conservatives making the argument that it isn't.
Yeah, they have actually, haven't they? They've said even to go there and have that conversation is the wrong choice, which, as you say, you know, it's a difficult calculation as to how that relationship needs to be looked at and worked on going forward.
Yeah, some MPs feel this very keenly. They've been sanctioned by China. There's, you know, accusations of industrial-level espionage conducted by China. There is sort of proliferation of folk on this trip who are taking all sorts of security precautions around the tech that they're using and using temporary phones. Now, that happens to a degree on plenty of international trips, but it's on another level on this trip. And so, yeah, is there a disjuncture between that tone and that language of warmth and connection and yet the reality of dealing with a country, a state that on a pretty fundamental level there is, to put it gently, big trust issues around? And for some, that's a bridge that the UK shouldn't be crossing. The Prime Minister's argument, and he's lent into this with a real sense of conviction, is that in his view it is pragmatic to lean into it because China is unavoidable on the economic and global and diplomatic and military stage, but you do so, in his view, clear-eyed about the risks. But that's always going to be tricky and, as I say, provokes that political argument.
Chris Mason, our political editor, thank you. We'll speak to one of those trade leaders who's travelling with the Prime Minister at 10 to 8.
7:15 to Wales we go. As part of our ongoing coverage of the forthcoming Welsh Senedd elections, Justin presented the programme from Cardiff this week, and we're speaking to all the main parties. Justin spoke to Labour's First Minister and Plaid Cymru. Emma spoke yesterday to the Conservatives, and we heard from the Lib Dems before the news. Today it's Reform, and so we say good morning to Jason O'Connell, who's the Reform Councillor in Torvain. Mr. O'Connell, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us in your time this morning. Why doesn't Reform have a leader in Wales?
Well, those announcements are going to be made very shortly indeed. We've been very thorough with our assessment of people who can make leader. So that announcement is due imminently, I would say. So,
imminently, we understand a couple of weeks?
Less than that. I think, you know, we understand the importance. We're not just selecting a leader, we're selecting a future First Minister. So it's right that we take the time to make sure that appointment is the correct one.
OK, and we've taken the time to look at your policies in Wales. We looked closely at your website and Facebook page, and we found, please do correct us if this is wrong, but found a total of 4 bespoke policies for Wales, which we'll get to. They concern asylum, skills training, the 20 mph limit and wasteful spending. Shouldn't you have a more comprehensive set of policies for the people of Wales by now?
Well, we absolutely should, and we are. We'll be announcing a full manifesto as we head into the short campaign, the same as every other party. So we've announced a high-level number of specific policies for Wales, such as removal of the 20-mile-an-hour speed limit and the Nation of Sanctuary status. So,
okay, let's get into those policies. So you want to end the Nation of Sanctuary policy. Do you know how much that's cost Wales? For instance, since, I mean, you could give us a timescale you like, but for instance, since 2019, either in absolute terms or as a proportion of the budget?
Yeah, it's a familiar argument, and I've heard the term, you know, £55 million over 5 years is a lot of money, but it's not about monetary value. This is a sign that this government has put above Wales, inviting people in that we don't know where they come from, we don't know their background, and they put pressure on our public services, so it's something that we have to address.
But we do know a bit about where they come from. Do you know what proportion of that £55 million, either in absolute terms or as a proportion of it, was spent on helping Ukrainians?
Well, again, the policy was actually put in place before the Ukrainian war took hold. So we understand that Ukrainians have taken advantage of the scheme, which is the right thing to do. We should be offering a helping hand to those that need it. But it's not about the specific monetary value of this. It's all to do with the message that it sends the world.
But
Wales is a very small country.
But budgetary issues are about monetary value, aren't they? So you're right to say £55 million, that's less than 0.5% of the budgets. Between 2022 and 2024, 82% of the money spent on the Nation of Sanctuary policy, that's around £45 million, was spent on Ukrainians. Do you think that was a bad way for Wales to spend money?
No, I don't. As I said, we've got to put our hand out and help those around the world that do need it, that genuinely need it, but we can't have an open-door policy. And I think, you know, we have to look at places like Ukraine that generally are going through periods of trouble and help people where we can. But it's important that we resettle those people effectively in our communities. And I understand that the pressures that have been put on those communities through resettlement, not only of Ukrainians, but other people around the world. And, you know, we've had, we've certainly been impacted by, you know, the open door policy during the Boris wave, and those people have settled in Wales and put genuine pressure on our local services.
Sure. Which voters do obviously care about hugely. You mentioned the speed limit. Official figures, again, tell us if you think these are wrong, but official figures suggest that since the introduction of the new speed limit, 100 fewer people or so have died in Wales. Wouldn't you consider that to be a policy win?
Well, the trajectory of those figures was heading in a downwards direction before the policy was implemented.
So there's a significantly steeper curve now that 20 mile per hour limit has been introduced, though.
Well, I don't accept that. My view is that it's not correlation, it's causation of this policy. I don't accept that it's as a direct result of this.
You think so? You think it's the other way around? You think it's correlation? You think it's just a correlative thing that since that limit was introduced, 100 fewer people have died? You don't think that's caused by the lower limit?
No, I think the data says that we were heading in that direction. And there's a massive economic impact to this policy. That I was with a company yesterday that offers public transportation, and that one company alone in my local area has had a hit of about £600,000 to their business. And that's £600,000 that can't be reinvested into jobs, into growth. And we believe this is a policy that when you spread that right across Wales, has had quite a dire economic impact. And that's the difference a Reform government will make in May, is to ensure that we put the economy at the heart of our offer.
Well, we hope we can continue to talk to your party about them, about your offer before those elections. Jason O'Connell from Reform, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, by the way, at 7:20 for your thoughts and your messages on something that we're focusing on this morning about young people and screen time and phones, whether you're a parent or a carer, or in fact, whether you're any of us, because this is the next generation who we're all going to be dealing with in one way or another. And we've had messages particularly as well from people with younger, well, not children anymore, grown up children. Glad that this is something which is actually on the agenda now. James says, my sons are now 19 and 22. With hindsight, they wish they'd had a social media ban when they were under 16. They think they would have had a better childhood, even though, and this is part of the issue, they would have objected to it at the time. And this message as well says, great to hear motivated and responsible parents who monitor and care about the amount and type of social media used. I teach in further education and meet many students who haven't had such a luxury.
Phones are both a curse. They limit the world, they reduce the ability to concentrate, but also with encouragement suggesting amazing apps, it can and does widen their worldview as well. But we need to teach them how directly to use them and use them well. And that is one of the things we're going to be picking up on after 8:30. We're going to really focus in on this with some useful advice, some statistics. We'll hear from the tech world as well. So lots of useful stuff coming on that particular topic after 8:30 this morning on the programme. Let's talk business, though, for the next few minutes, because it's been a very strong week for precious metals, but that has pulled back a little this morning. Felicity Hannah's back with more on that. Hello again.
Hello, yes. So the price of commodities like gold and silver have hit record high after record high over the last year. Gold, for example, has more than doubled since early 2025. Silver has more than tripled, although we have seen a bit of a dip this morning. Now, this is not just people getting ready for Valentine's Day. It's an investment. Gold is used in electronics. Central banks buy it for their reserves. So what's behind the current demand? Well, let's ask Douglas McNeil, senior advisor at Macro Advisory Partners and former advisor to three Conservative prime ministers. Douglas, morning. What is behind this huge hike in demand for gold and other precious metals?
Well, I think there are two things. One has been the emergence of inflation as a genuine concern for the first time in quite a few years. Inflation used to be very low, and then when COVID came along, inflation came back, and gold is traditionally seen as a hedge against inflation. So that's been part of the story here. The other thing was Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which led to a weaponization of the Western financial system against Russia, asset freezes, sanctions, that sort of thing. And that concentrated the minds of a number of central banks around the world in countries that wondered whether they might one day be on the receiving end of similar treatment. And so they decided that instead of owning things like US Treasury bonds, it might be a little bit safer to have some gold in their reserves. And so they bought a lot of gold. And that's the other factor that's pushed up the price.
OK, but those are factors that have been around quite a while. So, and those are definitely solid reasons. Do you think speculation, though, now is feeding this a bit? People are buying into gold, perhaps, because they think it'll go up tomorrow.
I think that probably is the case, because the way that the price has spiked in recent months and years is pretty extraordinary. As you say, doubled, more than doubled. And that suggests that there is quite a bit of speculative froth in this particular market. And the question will be, are there people out there who are perhaps playing with borrowed money or something and might find themselves coming a cropper if the price were to spike down again in the same way that it has spiked up?
Can we tell anything about the broader economy from a surge in what's often seen as a safe haven asset?
Well, it tells us that there are these jitters around inflation. It tells us that there are concerns about the inflation-fighting credentials of the US in particular, where there have been concerns that President Trump might be able to influence the Federal Reserve in a way that lessens its focus on fighting inflation. And that is one of the big regulators of the whole world economy. The fortunes of the US economy are absolutely central. If inflation were to get out of control there, then that would have repercussions for everybody. So I think that is one of the main lessons we can take away.
So we can tell more than just what gold is doing and gold investors. Douglas McNeil, Senior Advisor at Macro Advisory Partners. Thank you very much indeed.
Fliss, thank you very much indeed. It's 25 past seven in Syria. A ceasefire between the central government in Damascus and Kurdish fighters in the northeast of the country is due to expire in just over a week, so next Saturday, the 7th of February. The government is demanding that the Kurdish militia, who were crucial in defeating the so-called Islamic State a decade ago, disband and integrate into the Syrian army. There are fears about a possible all-out war and about the security of Kurdish-run prisons holding suspected IS fighters and the Rojh camp, where tens of thousands of their women and children are detained without trial. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Girin, now reports.
I'm in Al Rojh camp, where family members of suspected IS fighters have been detained for years. Stretching out in front of me, there are blue and white tents with numbers written on the side. It's a pretty bleak place. We're in the Syrian desert, but there's snow on top of the hills in front of me. And for years now, Kurdish forces have been keeping a tight grip on this camp and others like it. They say they've been protecting the world. They insist that many of those living here still believe in IS and want to see it make a comeback. We're with one of the women in the camp. She doesn't want to be named, but she has two children. Can I ask, how old are your children?
One is 9, one is 7 years.
And how long have you been here?
I'm 9 years almost here in the camp. My oldest son, he was 1 year and 8 months. Other, I born him here.
What is the mood like here at the moment?
We are very worried because we doesn't know what will happening. We hear some stories that here maybe it will be war. Honestly, we are really worried.
How do you feel about IS now?
I'm feeling so bad because I came here. I came with my husband. I'm destroying my life.
Do you wish you hadn't come?
Yeah, I will be so happy if I never didn't came in this place.
Do you think there is a chance you'll get home?
I hope so. Yeah.
Around 2,000 relatives of suspected IS fighters are detained in Rojh, among them 40 British women and children. There are no courts here and no trials, and some make no apologies for their past with IS. What would you say to people outside who say, you came and you joined IS and you don't have the right to go home?
First of all, I didn't join the organisation. My husband forced me to come here. He died, and my children and I are paying the price. We want to tell people that we are victims.
I want to leave this place so my daughter can study and live her life. She has a right to an education, to visit a park, to get medical care. If she's ill, God forbid, she should be able to go to a hospital like any other child, without soldiers going with us.
I'm with Hekmia Ibrahim, who is the manager of Rojh Camp. We're just standing by some of the tents. The sun is shining, but it's a bitterly cold morning. Everything here at the moment is calm and under control, but it's a very uncertain time. Do you think that IS will try and take advantage of this moment, maybe try and break people out of the camp?
Based on the current situation across the region, anything is possible and anything could happen, especially given that ISIS cells have become very strong. Syria as a whole has become like a swamp for Daesh. A situation that allows the group to rebuild itself again.
And if there is all-out war here, IS stands to benefit from the chaos.
That's Ola Guerin reporting from Rojh Camp in northeast Syria. It's just coming round to 7:30. It's time for the sport. Mike's back.
Anna, thank you. Let's head straight back to Melbourne. We told you last hour how world number one Carlos Alcaraz had been coasting in his semi-final against Alex Zverev at the Australian Open. He was two sets up, on the verge of winning a third and taking the match, only then to suffer some sort of groin strain. He called a medical timeout, ended up losing the third set on a tiebreak, and is still clearly struggling with this injury, Russell Fuller. He was 2 points away from the final at one point, wasn't he? He's now having to dig deep. What's the latest?
Into a fourth set, Mike, and Alex Zverev leads by 4-3, but Alcaraz has a point to level at 4-4, and therefore this set is on serve. Was Zverev right to be unhappy with the medical timeout Alcaraz received late in the third set? Zverev thought that Alcaraz was cramping. You're not allowed treatment for that, and there is some evidence to back that up. We've seen a massage at change of ends on the other leg of Alcaraz, and also he's been downing pickle juice, which is something players often take advantage of when they are cramping. It's now 4-4. Alcaraz is moving better. A little bit of strength has returned to his serve, but he's still in a very dicey position indeed, despite leading by 2-1.
Will the pickle juice help get him over the line? You can follow coverage of that over on the BBC Sport website right now. The winner will face either Jannik Sinner or Novak Djokovic in the other semi-final. Later on, you'll be able to hear that match on BBC Sounds. Russell's still with us because away from the current action at the Australian Open, Russell, The other big tennis news that broke late yesterday is concerns Emma Raducanu, who has split with another coach. She's ended her partnership with the Spaniard Francis Roig after just 6 months. Raducanu now looking for her 10th coach in 5 years, is it?
Well, if you include a trialist and a caretaker coach, you can use that number. This has come not as a surprise given the events of the last month, but certainly a surprise when they agreed to work together for the season at the end of last year. It emerged earlier in the month that there were some creative differences between the two, that there was some friction in the camp, and after Raducanu lost to Anastasia Potapova in the second round of the Australian Open, she said in a news conference that she wants to be playing a different way. She talked about a misalignment. She wants to return to the way she was playing with such freedom at the US Open that she won as a teenager in 2021. So having said that, and effectively saying I see it a different way to my coach, it's no surprise that they have gone their separate ways. It's an interesting question, isn't it, really? Who should decide the direction and style of play? Should it be the coach, or should the player be able to say to the coach, I want to play like this, please show me how to do it? But ultimately, Raducanu was encouraged to develop a game style that she did not believe in.
All right, Russell Fuller, live in Melbourne, many thanks. And a reminder that Alcaraz match still ongoing. Follow that online. Just briefly, away from tennis, in football, wins for Aston Villa, Nottingham Forest and Celtic in the final round of Europa League matches last night. All three of those teams progress to the knockout round. Defeat, though, for already eliminated Rangers. And just to say, England's cricketers are in action later today out in Sri Lanka, the first T20 international. We will look ahead to that in the next hour of the programme.
Pickle juice, I read on the BBC Sport website, reduces cramping 40% faster than water.
Yeah, well, England footballers at the last Euros swore by it, that they were having it sent out in the caseload. So.
Just tastes 100% more disgusting, too. next week on Radio 4, crime through a psychological lens.
Women rarely murder.
Award-winning drama inspired by real life.
And when they do, the victim is almost always someone close to them.
A forensic psychiatrist dealing with the impact of fatal violence.
I'm Dr. Alex Bridges. I help make sense of the senseless.
I just need to know if there was something I missed.
But when feelings are buried and a terrible truth is withheld, the darkness within can have a catastrophic impact.
The new series of This Thing of Darkness on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Starting this Tuesday at 2:15.
The weather today will be cloudy for most of us, some patchy rain and hill snow in the north and strong winds and heavy rain in the south and west. But if you are in Northern Ireland, treat for you, you get a few bright spells.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Amol Rajan in London. It's 26 minutes to 8 and here you heard him a moment ago. It's a summary of the news from Tom Sanders.
President Trump has said that it would be dangerous for the UK to do more business with China. The Prime Minister is currently in the country to strengthen economic ties with Beijing. In response to President Trump's remarks, Downing Street indicated that Washington was aware of this trip and its objectives in advance and pointed out the president is due in China himself in April. Ukraine appears to have had a quieter night after President Trump said Vladimir Putin had agreed to pause airstrikes on towns and cities in the country for a week because of the extreme weather conditions there. Ukraine is facing its harshest winter since Russia's full-scale invasion began in 2022. Two serving British Army officers will face a court-martial in relation to the handling of the case of sexual assault of a 19-year-old soldier. Gunner Jaisley Beck killed herself at Larkhill Camp in Wiltshire in December 2021, 5 months after she was assaulted by former battery sergeant Michael Webber. He was subsequently jailed. Police have arrested two men in connection with a 20,000-tonne illegal waste site in Kidlington in Oxfordshire. The Environment Agency said the men, aged 68 and 54, were detained on suspicion of environmental and money laundering offences and had been released on conditional bail. The National Audit Office says the Ministry of Defence has recovered less than half the money it spent on detecting and tackling fraud and theft during the past 4 years. Many cases of fraud relate to pay and expenses, but in 2024 there were more than 2,000 reports of stolen assets such as weapons and armour. The MOD said it had zero tolerance for fraud and corruption. Doctors say more research is needed to establish whether a link exists between the use of weight loss jabs and gallbladder removals. There was a 15% increase in such operations in 2024-25 compared with the previous year. Manufacturers say the safety of patients are their top priority, and anyone experiencing side effects should talk to a healthcare professional.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. 24 minutes to 8. We're pro-experimentation and pro-listener on the Today programme, and so we're going to do something slightly different this morning, which will carry on into next week. We have had a huge, huge and very, very passionate response to our request that you get in touch and let us know your experience and your views on this whole issue of young people and technology, particularly social media and smartphones. Rachel got in touch to say how her children's phone use has impacted her parenting.
We have two daughters and we were not going to give them a phone until they were around 16 or so, but unfortunately had to change their school and we wanted to help them fit in and not be the weird kids who didn't have a phone, so we did give them one. We both kind of feel that phones have somewhat ruined our experience of parenting. We have set limits. They are constantly pushed and I do look at their phones to look at what they're looking at. But I know there are places they can hide things that I can't access, and they can work their way around passwords and clearly addicted to them. I worry about their future, you know, the need to be entertained constantly, having very short attention spans, witnessing adult material well before, you know, they should. How can they just be creative or sit with their experiences when they've had access to constant information and entertainment? We don't use our phones that much. I didn't grow up with a phone and I'm very thankful that I did not. I wish that phones had really never been invented, and I think the ban does need to happen. Yes, kids will find a way around it, but so what? You know, things have got to change.
Well, thank you very much indeed to Rachel for that message. I wonder how many of you were agreeing with that and nodding along whilst having your breakfast. Beth says, got in touch to say that our reliance on phones makes it hard to not use them in front of children.
I desire to set a good example to my children, but so much life admin is done on my phone. Both my children's schools use apps, and through these I arrange school dinners, read messages, give consent, pay for trips. Another app might be used for schoolwork, setting of homework and messaging the class teacher. Then there's the app for buses, and that's all on top of banking, shopping and managing the household. I'm not sure how we'd ever come back from society's dependence on digital tools, and I don't think we will or necessarily should. However, I'm incredibly grateful to hear frank discussions about screen time and its impact on us as individuals and communities. The social media ban is a starting point. Of course, it can be circumvented, but it sends a clear message that we need to think about the use of digital media carefully. It needs to be acknowledged that we, our society, are completely dependent on these digital tools, and that collectively we can improve how we manage these in our lives.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that message, Beth. I should say, if you're interested in those conversations, next Thursday, Professor Jonathan Haidt is our guest on Radical, our weekly podcast. He's the author, of course, of The Anxious Generation, a huge influence on the current international debate. That's a high energy conversation, and you'll hear plenty of challenge to his views. Next Tuesday evening at 8 p.m, I'm hosting the Today debate live on this issue. We have had an exceptionally high demand for that event, and I've got to tell you, we've now closed the ticket website, I'm afraid. Today, we're dedicating the final half hour of the programme to this issue. What does the science say? What should parents, what should schools do? Do we have the right laws? And if powerful technology has over the past two decades come for our attention, is it now coming for our attachments, our relationships, particularly in the age of AI? Let's turn to public sentiment first here with Gideon Skinner, who is a Senior Director of UK Politics in Public Affairs at Ipsos, and also Dr. Guy Northover, Chair of the Child and Adolescent Faculty at the Royal College of Psychiatrists. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Gideon, great to have you with us in the studio. Just where is public sentiment on this issue of the ban?
So this is in the context of wider Ipsos research showing that concern about mental health is seen as one of the biggest challenges facing young people today. Social media isn't the only factor there? And, you know, broadly, people think that the benefits of mobile phones outweigh the disadvantages. But excessive use of social media and technology is one of the key concerns for the public. And in that context, there is majority support for a ban on mobile phones going into schools. 56% would ban that. And that has increased about 8 points since 2024. And around 7 in 10 would say they support age verification checks on to stop young people under 16s going on social media.
So support for a ban, support that's getting stronger. I mean, 8% since 2024 is quite a striking increase. What about, do we know anything about how it splits between young and old, or how it splits between men and women?
So women tend to be a bit more supportive of age verification checks on social media. Younger people slightly less so. Younger people are split when it comes to a mobile phone ban in schools. If we're talking about, I'm talking about under 30 adults, really, rather than children. I think a scientific survey of my 13-year-old at dinner table last night suggested there was 100% opposition to a mobile phone ban. But younger adults are a bit less in support of some of these actions, but still a majority of young people are in favour of social media for verification checks.
Great. I think that survey of 13-year-olds happens on a daily occasion in most households. Lucky enough to have a 13-year-old. Dr. Guy Northover, you've spent many decades looking at this issue. We'll get into the behaviour in a moment. Can I just ask you, Dr. Northover, first on the science, the neuroscience, is there definitive evidence of the impact these technologies are having on highly plastic young minds?
So I think this is a really interesting question. And what I would say to this, first of all, it's agreeing, isn't it, that protecting children's mental health must absolutely be a public health priority. And within that, we know that we do need to look and we need to research social media and the online lives that our children are engaging with. But we are somewhat hamstrung with this because we know that tech companies have large amounts of data that we just can't get access to. So social media and tech companies must be held to account. We need a suite of regulations with strong consequences for inaction so we can start researching this area appropriately and effectively so we can really start answering these questions that you've just asked.
And how do you think parents should start sort of approaching these issues in a way that tries to avoid conflict?
The first thing is this is not just a parent's responsibility.
Sure.
Here. There are certainly some things that parents need to be thinking about, but parents need support, again, within the regulations. We need to have safe online spaces so that parents can be assured that when their child is going online, that they are doing it in a safe way. But if parents are concerned around this, then it's about making sure that they are understanding the online world that their children are going on to. I mean, one recent survey I looked at suggested that over 60% of teenagers use AI chatbots for conversations. And I think if you're a parent and you're trying to engage your child in conversations around online harms, if you're not sure what that means or what that looks like, you're already coming from a point where your child is unlikely to be listening to you and understanding what you're saying.
Did you just say that 60% of teenagers use chatbots for conversations?
Have used chatbots for conversations. That was a recent survey,
right,
that I saw.
Okay.
And this is the challenge that we have. Whilst we are looking at social media, there's always something else there. And if we're not careful, we're always going to be behind the curve.
Yeah.
So we need to really understand how these environments are being used and the impact that this may well have on our children.
Okay. Dr. Northover, thank you. Gideon Skinner from Ipsos. If I just come back to you for one final thought, in terms of public sentiment, where do the public see responsibility for any change which they support lying? Is it schools? Is it politicians? Is it parents?
So I think, reflecting the earlier point, the public thinks there is shared societal responsibility around this. So most of all, they think the parents and social media companies, around 9 in 10 for each of those, think that there's responsibility there for protecting children from harmful content. But it's not just them. 8 in 10, so almost as many, also say the government has responsibility, the regulators have responsibility. Indeed, other adults using social media also have responsibility. So it's a shared responsibility in the eyes of the public.
Is the implication of all that you're saying, if we tie these threads together, that there is a sort of remorseless political logic, frankly, to a consensus in Parliament that a ban is coming?
So certainly if we look at public sentiment across the parties, this is one of those maybe relatively rare subjects where broadly support for further action is shared across supporters of different parties.
OK, thank you very much, Gideon Skinner from Ipsos, and also Dr. Guy Northover. Appreciate your time.
It's 14 minutes to 8. Let's talk about something a little bit different. We're going to focus on that from 8.30 till the end of the programme. But this, you know, tech of a different kind, the first crewed mission to the moon in decades, could be on its way through the Earth's atmosphere as soon as this time next week. That is because Friday, the 6th of February, is the first possible date for liftoff for the Artemis 2 mission. It's the first time that humans will travel back to the moon since the 1970s. What they are planning is a 10-day lunar flyby, so it will loop around the moon without actually landing there. Not this time, that's for Artemis 3. But what it is the first step towards establishing a permanent lunar base that can facilitate more missions to the moon or to Mars and beyond. So tomorrow, NASA completes its pre-flight tests. But to mark what will be a momentous mission, we thought we would hear from some of the astronauts who walked on the moon as part of that Apollo program over 50 years ago. And who else to start with but Neil Armstrong, the first man to set foot on the moon. So here he is, speaking to Patrick Moore on an episode of the BBC's The Sky at Night from 1970, describing what the Earth looked like from the moon.
The Earth is quite beautiful from space and from the moon. It looks quite small and quite remote, but it's very blue and covered with white lace and of the clouds. And the continents are clearly seen, although they have very little color from that distance.
There's just one more thing I'd like to ask you. You're one of the very, very few people, I think, whose opinion on this is really worth having. In fact, there are only four of you. Do you think, from your knowledge of the moon, having been there, that it is going to be possible in the foreseeable future to set up scientific bases there on anything like a large scale?
Oh, I'm quite certain that we'll have such bases in our lifetime, somewhat like the Antarctic stations and similar scientific outposts, continually manned. Although, certainly, there's the problem of the environment, the vacuum, and the high and low temperatures of day and night. Still in all, in many ways, it's more hospitable than Antarctica might be. There are no storms, no snow, no high winds, no unpredictable weather phenomena that we're yet aware of. And the gravity is a very pleasant kind of place to work in, better than here on Earth. And I think it would be quite a pleasant place to do scientific work and quite practical.
Wonderful. What a wonderful clip that was. Now, it's 12 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker with us in the morning, always a pleasure to see, Catherine Pepinster, former editor of The Tablet and Catholic commentator.
Good morning, Amal. Thursday night saw a glitzy premiere at Windsor Castle, complete with film stars on the red carpet. But rather than a Hollywood blockbuster or homegrown movie, this was the launch of a documentary by the King. Called Finding Harmony, it will be released next week. It's being promoted as the King's vision for the planet, while the head of the King's charity, the King's Foundation, says it's about his philosophy of harmony. While the documentary explores the King's well-known love of nature and his thoughts on the future of the planet, his interest in the philosophy of harmony is perhaps not so well known. Yet it's something that he's been mulling over for decades. A whole section of a two-volume set of his speeches is devoted to harmony, what he calls a grammar that underscores art, architecture and spirituality of all the great religions. He spoke about this harmony in a speech at the UN Climate Change Conference COP28 in late 2023. There's a moment from a few years earlier in the documentary which shows the then Prince Charles joking that people thought his ideas were dotty. It was sandals and long hair, he said. But the idea of harmony owes its origins to ancient Greek and Christian thinking. In a speech he gave in 2015 in Louisville, Kentucky, Prince Charles urged people to develop joined-up thinking about interdependent relationships within nature. The ancient Greek word for the process of joining things up was harmonia, he said, so joined-up thinking needs to create harmony. This idea of harmony is evident in Plato's work The Timaeus, where he describes the cosmos as a collection of elements arranged in musical ratios, and this internal harmony ensures its survival. While St. Ambrose, one of the earliest Christian writers, saw the creation of the world described in the book of Genesis as a narrative about harmony with a balance between the elements. He saw the way voices are lifted in harmony as symbolising the greater harmony of God's creation. Someone else who, like the King, expressed concern at a lack of harmony in the way people live now was Pope Francis. In his major work on the environment, Laudato Si, he warned that humanity's arrogance in attempting to dominate planet Earth had upset the balance of creation. The harmony between the Creator, humanity and creation as a whole was disrupted by our presuming to take the place of God and refusing to acknowledge our creaturely limitations, he wrote. In other words, if there's any chance of the joined-up thinking the King calls for in our relationship with one another and with nature, a starting point for harmony needs to be humility.
That was Thought for the Day with Catherine Pepinster, former editor of The Tablet, Catholic commentator. The time now is 8:09.
President Trump has said that it's very dangerous for the UK to deepen its business ties with China, even as the Prime Minister meets trade leaders again on the final leg of his three-day trip. Sir Keir Starmer has been happy with what he's called real progress after saying back in December, you'll remember, that the UK-China relationship needed a reset fit for the future. But will the US President's warning or criticism from the opposition at home take the gloss off that? Have the achievements of the trip been great enough to make any potential damage to the UK's friendship with the US worthwhile? Well, Sir Sebastian Wood is chair of the China-Britain Business Council and is travelling with the Prime Minister. He's also a former British ambassador to China. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
How should the Prime Minister deal with those comments by President Trump?
Well, I just note that President Trump's officials have been working extremely hard on a wide-ranging economic package deal with China, which will probably be sealed when the president visits China in April. I think that it's pretty clear that the Trump administration believes that economic engagement with China is extremely important to their national interest. And it's also extremely important to our national interest. And the Prime Minister is absolutely right to be visiting China and promoting business between our two countries.
When you look at the US reaction to the Canadian visit to China and the problems that caused, you don't foresee a world in which choices have to be made in terms of which superpower you decide to be closest to?
I think it's almost unthinkable. If we look at this economically, there are three great markets in the world today. There's the United States, there's the European single market, and there's China. And Britain is an independent trading country. Openness and trade are absolutely in our DNA as a country. And if we want jobs and growth in our country, we absolutely have to have the best possible trading and investment relationship in all three of those markets. We cannot afford to ignore any of them, and we can't afford to be choosing between them.
It's interesting, you started your answers there by saying if we look at this economically and if we look at it diplomatically, it's slightly different. It can be awkward to try and untangle the two, can't it?
It can, and the government has set out a structure, a three-pillar structure for our relationship with China. We challenge where we must, we compete where it's necessary, and we cooperate where it's in our mutual interest to do so. And there are, of course, enormous areas of economic mutual interest between the UK and China. Business engagement between our two countries is absolutely part of that cooperate strand of the government's policy, and businesses are enthusiastically engaging with China today as the world's second largest economy.
There are some questions, and in fact more than questions, there are some criticisms that what's been announced so far, what's been signed and what's been unveiled doesn't really match up to expectations, match up to what people were led to believe would be achieved from this trip. We're seeing visa-free travel, which is supposed to be coming, but already exists for many, many other countries. Positive things for whiskey manufacturers. But actually, do you think there has been a lack of really substantive agreements on this trip so far?
No, I wouldn't characterize it like that at all, Anna. This is a historic visit. It's a milestone. For 8 years, we've had no British Prime Minister visiting China. The UK had become an outlier. All of our major Western partners, the Germans, the French, even the Americans, have had regular cabinet-level contact with the Chinese over that period of time. And this matters to business. China is, you know, it's a very political economy. Big Chinese firms, they think about the political relationship before they do big deals, before they make serious commitments to their business partners. And we don't want Chinese corporations thinking they might be criticized for signing a big contract with a UK company rather than a French company or an American company. And this is a very strong signal that the political relationship, the working relations have been resumed up to leader level between us. The political relationship is now solid and healthy. And I would expect this to lead to an increased flow of mutually beneficial trade and investment between our two countries now, because it'll give our Chinese partners the confidence to choose Britain when they're looking for deals and partners.
You're very confident, and I would expect you to be, but there are still those who say, well, this is a step along the way. There are still diplomatic issues. There are still MPs, for example, who are sanctioned by China. At what point do things like that need to change for this to be viewed as a successful relationship?
Well, let me just sketch out what I think is the really big opportunity here. China is getting more prosperous and more wealthy. It has a gigantic middle class, more than 500 million people. And as countries get richer, their people spend more and more of their income on consumption, in particular on services. And we already have a trade surplus in services with China, but China's leaders want to open up services more to foreign participation. Okay. This is a gigantic services market, which is just beginning to open up.
And okay, we'll need to leave it there, I'm afraid, but thank you for joining us. And we heard the point that you were making there, Sir Sebastian Wood.
2 minutes to eight. Here's Alex Forsyth with a look ahead to this evening's Any Questions.
Good morning. Tonight we are in the small town of Faisley, which is not far from Tamworth in Staffordshire. And joining me there to address the issues on the minds of our audience will be the Transport Minister, Lillian Greenwood, the Shadow Health Secretary, Stuart Andrew, the writer and broadcaster, Ash Sarkar, and the Telegraph columnist, Annabel Denham. We have still got a few tickets left, so for the chance to come along and put your question to the panel, go to the BBC Any Questions website where you will find all of the details. If not, then listen live at 8 p.m. here on Radio 4.
Thanks, Alex. Let's get the weather here. Simon King.
Anna, thanks so much indeed. It's a rather damp and chilly start to your Friday morning. But for Wales, southwest and southeast England, much of the rain is starting to clear away to the northeast. We've got a few showers around South Wales at the moment. There may even be a few brighter skies developing for a time. However, in southwest England, we've got some rain that's going to move its way in later this morning that will gradually spread its way further north and eastward and covering most areas, except perhaps the far north of Wales and towards London and the far southeast of England, that rain not arriving until right at the end of the day, but temperatures getting to about 7 to 11 degrees. Now for the Midlands, eastern England, northwest and northeast England, quite a lot of wet weather out there this morning. That rain, some drizzle, is going to move its way north and eastward. Eventually it'll dry out for the Midlands, eastern England, northwest England, a few bright spells perhaps. Temperatures getting to about 6 to 10 Celsius. For Northern Ireland, rain this morning, gradually clearing, a bit drier this afternoon, still a few showers, highs of 8 or 9. And across Scotland, wintry showers across eastern Scotland, but across southern and central areas, we're going to see some cloud increasing, rain moving its way in, a bit of hill snow here. The driest and brightest weather in the northwest of Scotland and temperatures of 2 to 6 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much. Indeed, it has gone to a fifth set between Zverev and Alcaraz in Melbourne.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 30th of January. The headlines this morning: Donald Trump has warned Keir Starmer, who's on a visit to China, against boosting business ties with Beijing, calling it very dangerous. Russia has significantly reduced its drone and missile attacks against Ukraine after the US president said he'd urge Vladimir Putin not to carry out attacks in extremely low temperatures. And two serving army officers will face a court-martial over the way they handled the case of a teenage soldier who was sexually assaulted.
We're doing something a little different with the programme this morning. From 8.30, we'll be dedicating the programme to taking a long, hard look at social media, phones and screen time. If you're a parent or carer trying to deal with the challenges of how you manage your children and you use it at home, we're going to try to help. Hundreds of you have been getting in touch with us all week to tell us your concerns. This is what Heather had to say.
I'm a teacher from London, and I can promise you that the only thing that makes the teenagers cry is to confiscate their phone and say it needs to be kept in school overnight. Teenagers really struggle to manage their screen time, and it's not their fault.
We're also talking crucially about some possible solutions.
The first principle, this is the one I wish I'd done, is no screens of any kind in bedrooms ever. This stuff is like a gas that expands to fill every moment. So if you have that rule, it won't fill every moment of your kid's day.
And in just over 20 minutes, we're going to be talking about the most successful scientific equation in history as quantum mechanics marks its 100th birthday. The BBC News is read this morning by Tom Sanders.
President Trump has claimed it would be dangerous for the UK to do more business with China as the Prime Minister works to strengthen economic ties with the country on the third day of his trip there. Mr. Trump's warning is similar in tone to the Conservatives, who've accused the Prime Minister of kowtowing to China. This morning, Sir Keir Starmer, who's insisted he won't choose between Beijing and Washington, has arrived in Shanghai after meeting President Xi yesterday. Our political editor Chris Mason is travelling with the Prime Minister.
As Downing Street leaves the door open for a return trip to the UK for President Xi, more than a decade on from his four-day state visit in 2015, the perhaps near-inevitable commentary from the White House on the Prime Minister's journey east. Donald Trump, attending the premiere of the documentary film Melania about his wife, was asked this.
Mr. President, what do you think about the UK getting into business with China? Keir Starmer was in Beijing.
Well, it's very dangerous for them to do that, and it's even more dangerous, I think, for Canada to get into business with China.
Earlier at the Bank of China in Beijing, Sir Keir Starmer told British and Chinese business leaders his meeting with President Xi was very warm, and he wants to build a mutual trust and respect, as he put it, between the UK and China. His critics say the Chinese state simply cannot be trusted. In response to President Trump's remarks, Downing Street indicated that Washington was aware of this trip and its objectives in advance and pointed out the president is due in China himself in April.
A former British ambassador to China, Sir Sebastian Wood, is now the chairman of the China-Britain Business Council. He's travelling with the Prime Minister and told us it was important for Britain to have good relations with China, and he believes Mr. Trump agreed.
President Trump's officials have been working extremely hard on a wide-ranging economic package deal with China, which will probably be sealed when the president visits China in April. So I think that it's pretty clear that the Trump administration believes that economic engagement with China is extremely important to their national interest. And it's also extremely important to our national interest. And the Prime Minister is absolutely right to be visiting China and promoting business between our two countries.
Donald Trump says he told Iran that if it wants to avoid US military action, it must do two things, no nuclear and stop killing protesters. He said it would be great if he didn't have to use the very big, very powerful ships currently sailing to Iran. Most of Ukraine has had a quiet night after Donald Trump said President Putin had agreed not to bomb the country during a week-long spell of extremely cold weather. There are warnings the harsh winter and the attacks on energy plants are leading to a humanitarian catastrophe. There's been no comment from the Kremlin. Abdujalil Abdurasulov sent this report from Kyiv.
Overnight, air raid alerts have gone off only in four regions of Ukraine that are close to the front line and border Russia. Ukraine's Air Force claims Moscow launched 80 drones and a ballistic missile as the fighting continues there. But areas away from the front line had a rare night without sirens. This pause of Russian strikes comes at a time when the temperature in some parts of Ukraine is forecast to drop to minus 30 degrees Celsius in the next few days. Thousands of people still have no heating at home in the Kyiv region following the latest Russian attack. Emergency power cuts are continuing across the country. Response teams are working round the clock to repair power facilities. But this task is extremely challenging.
President Trump has described the man who was shot dead by immigration enforcement officers in Minneapolis last week as an agitator and perhaps insurrectionist. Alex Preti was killed while protesting against the federal agent's presence in the city. Mr. Trump claimed Mr. Preti's stock had gone way down after a video emerged, reportedly showing an altercation between him and agents 11 days before his killing. Two serving British Army officers are to face a court-martial in relation to the handling of the case of a sexual assault of a teenage soldier. Gunner Jaisley Beck, who was 19, killed herself at her barracks at Larkhill Camp in Wiltshire in December 2021, 5 months after she was assaulted by former battery sergeant Michael Webber. He was subsequently jailed for 6 months for the attack. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
Jaisley Beck's inquest last year heard the Army's handling of her complaint of sexual assault had played more than a minimal contributory part in her death. At the time, the Army said it was profoundly sorry for the failings identified at the inquest. The Service Prosecution Authority has now charged two officers who were in Jaisley Beck's chain of command when she first reported the sexual assault. The BBC's been told they're Major James Hook and Colonel Samantha Shepherd. They were both made aware of her complaint before she took her own life. In a statement, the Ministry of Defence confirmed that two individuals have been charged with offences under Section 19 of the Armed Forces Act, which relates to conduct prejudicial to good order and service discipline. In response, Jaisley's mother, Leanne McCready, said that more than 4 years after her death, her family were very relieved to have got to this point. She said it would not be appropriate to comment further.
The Ministry of Defence has recovered less than half the money it spent on detecting and tackling fraud and theft over the past 4 years. Weapons and laptops are among the stolen items. The National Audit Office says the MOD needs to simplify its systems to tackle fraud. Matthew Carter reports.
The National Audit Office says the Ministry of Defence has taken steps to tackle theft and fraud, but should do more. For every pound the MOD spends on detecting these crimes, it only recovers 48 pence. Many cases of fraud relate to pay and expenses, but in 2024, the MOD received more than 2,000 reports of stolen assets, 30% of them about the theft of weapons, armour and communications systems. The Ministry of Defence said it had zero tolerance for fraud and corruption and had put in place robust controls.
Specialist doctors have said more research is needed into whether a link exists between the use of weight loss injections and an increase in gallbladder removals. In 2024-25, just over 80,000 such operations were carried out by NHS England, up 15% on the previous year. Manufacturers say the safety of patients is their top priority. James Hughes, a consultant bariatric surgeon, says there's anecdotal evidence to suggest a link.
I would say that more patients are presenting to me with gallstone problems who have taken Mounjaro or who are still on it. So I would say that would be the case. It's difficult to know for certain whether that's related to Mounjaro, but it would make sense because we know that gallstones are more common in patients who've lost weight rapidly.
The first ever Deputy First Minister of Scotland, Lord Jim Wallace, has died. He was 71 and had suffered complications as a result of surgery. As Scottish Liberal Democrat leader, Jim Wallace campaigned for devolution and brought in key policies in the Scottish Parliament's early days. Our Scotland editor James Cook looks back at Lord Wallace's life.
After studying law at Cambridge and Edinburgh, he was elected in 1983 as MP for Orkney and Shetland and, in the House of Commons, led the Liberal charge for devolution of power to Scotland.
In practical political terms, in the terms that will affect the everyday lives of the Scottish people, these proposals present us with an opportunity to create in Scotland a powerful and effective parliament which will properly represent Scotland's political interests and priorities.
In 1999, as Scotland's first Deputy First Minister in coalition with Labour, Jim Wallace helped to introduce state-funded personal care for the elderly and a Freedom of Information Act. He repeatedly stepped in to deputise for Labour First Ministers in times of tragedy and scandal, gaining widespread respect as a calm and canny operator and a decent, well-liked man.
Historic England is beginning work to study nearly 500,000 items recovered during archaeological digs along the route of the HS2 railway line. Harriet Bradshaw has had exclusive access to the archive.
A hand axe used more than 40,000 years ago, what's thought to be a Roman gladiator tag and 19th century gold dentures. These are just some of the 450,000 pieces found during the HS2 excavations and now being stored for further study. Archaeologists were employed at 60 sites along the London to Birmingham route as part of compulsory assessments to protect possible heritage. The Centre for British Archaeology says it's hoped they'll yield new insights into Britain's past. It's still not known whether these objects will stay in storage in the long term or be displayed in museums. The ownership of some is also still to be decided.
Harriet Bradshaw reporting.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It's 11 minutes past eight. Is America about to attack Iran? In recent days, America has amassed a mighty military force referred to by President Trump as an armada in the waters south of Iran. The aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln, accompanied by three warships, is now stationed in the Arabian Sea. Further north, in the Gulf of Oman, those waters that separate Bahrain and Oman to the south from Iran to the north, there are three more combat ships and two destroyers. That puts them well within striking distance of dozens of targets in Iran. If America does strike, how might it do so, and with what medium-term plans? If there was one lesson that Washington was meant to take and learn from the Iraq wars, it is epistemological humility. There is a limit to what they know about peoples and places far away. And if America does strike, is such action just? Carl von Clausewitz laid down principles two centuries ago, which remain a valuable framework here, whether or not he's been widely read by Trump's team. A just war, the Prussian general argued, must pass six tests. It should have just cause, right intentions, likelihood of success, legitimate authority, be proportionate, and be a last resort. America may struggle to tick all six boxes. But Iran today, a theocracy and a gerontocracy, is an economic basket case where what goes in the weekly basket is unaffordable to most. Inflation is over 40%, interest rates around 23%, and the rial, the currency, has lost 64% of its value in 6 months. Millions, perhaps tens of millions, perhaps even a majority of Iranians are desperate for emancipation from the butchery and the beggary imposed by the self-styled Islamic regime. Let's speak to Lise Doucette, our BBC chief international correspondent. Lise, I know you're monitoring events in Iran very, very closely. You've got impeccable contacts there. Just tell us a bit about what's happening and what's unfolding diplomatically, and particularly the role of Turkey in trying to cool things down.
Yes, well, today is a day of diplomacy, and those who see military strikes as imminent and unavoidable, and there are many who do, would call this really last-ditch diplomacy. As you say, the main table today seems to be Turkey. Turkey is now positioning itself as a key mediator between Iran and the United States. And today, Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, will be in Turkey to meet his counterpart, Hakan Fidan. And Hakan Fidan has been making some really interesting statements in public. He's making it clear to the U.S., as are many Arab leaders, some of them have gone to Washington, that it would be, in his words, wrong to attack Iran, that Iran was ready to negotiate. But he's been equally candid with Iran, saying Iran had to create trust in the region. And then he obliquely referred to Iran facing challenges at the bargaining table. What does he refer to? And I think he's referring to the fact Iran still says no direct face-to-face talks with the U.S. Even U.S. officials in the Biden administration used to complain that indirect talks are a waste of time. Secondly, Iran's biggest challenge with the U.S. is its maximalist demands. Zero enrichment, nuclear enrichment, limits on their ballistic missiles. In other words, no missiles which can reach Israel, no support to its military proxies and partners. And Iran's foreign minister keeps using words like this, fair talks, talks based on respect. In other words, not demands that are tantamount for us to surrender. And in a sign of the times, he's now using, like President Trump, caps in his messaging. So the last two messages from both of them, head in caps, no nuclear weapons.
What's happening in terms of Iran's leadership? I know it's very difficult getting accurate information out of the country, but if anyone can, I think you can, Lise. What do we know about the leadership there and whether or not there are rumblings of discontent?
Something very interesting has happened, Amal. We've covered widely this unprecedented wave of protests, which was put down with unprecedented lethal force. And in a quieter way, but still a very powerful way, now there's a new, I don't want to call it a phase, but a new kind of protest. And it's an extraordinary one, that in recent days, there's been very, very strong statements from Iran's opposition inside the country, in civil and in civil society. And inside the country means in prison or under house arrest. It includes prominent individuals, as well as the Writers Association, some of the unions. You had the former prime minister and the presidential candidate in Iran in 2009, Mir Hussein Mousavi. He has been under house arrest since 2009. What is he saying to the leadership? Lay down your guns and step down. And from inside Evin prison, there's a statement from one of the most prominent political prisoners, Said Mustafa Tajazadeh. He's calling for an independent inquiry into the massacres, and he describes the official account as a disgraceful lie. Okay. They often speak out, but they don't speak out like that. And it reminds you, just about lastly, Iran did have opportunities earlier to listen to the reformists and to reform, but it never listened.
Lee Suzette, thank you very much indeed, as ever. Well, earlier I spoke to Ezra Cohen, who served as the acting Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence during the first Trump administration. I started by asking him what calculations President Trump and his administration will be making on if or when to strike Iran.
Well, the president is clearly given the instructions to keep his options available. The Pentagon is moving various military forces into the region. These aren't, you know, at levels that, you know, have never been seen before. I mean, obviously, the Middle East has seen a lot of American forces over the past 20 years, but it's certainly an increase over the past 6 to 7 months. At the same time, the president has said he's continuing to keep a line of dialogue open with the Iranian regime. And I think you're going to see a very similar play here in the sense of what we saw in Venezuela, in the sense that we are going to bring, the president's going to bring military force to bear, or at least the option of that, while also continuing to engage with them for a non-military result.
So you say the option. Is there a sense in which at some point President Trump might feel he has to act? He said to the protesters, help is on its way. As you say, he's mobilized what he calls this armada. Is there a sense in which at some point, if he doesn't act, he might fear that he looks weak?
Well, I don't think it really comes down to that. I think there are a few things. The president's laid out his objectives very clearly. He said, one, you know, Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. He's been saying that since his first campaign pre-2017. And he's been very consistent and clear about that. The second thing, as he said, is, you know, we've got to treat these protesters well. You know, he doesn't want any sort of retaliation against them. But there's another thing, too, which is the fact that Iran is supporting the Chinese economy with cheap oil. And it's also been the primary destabilizing force in the region, but it's also destabilized things in the Western Hemisphere. And so there's a lot of reasons why the president wants to take action against Iran.
Can you just give us a sense, for those of us who aren't close to these conversations, if America were to mobilize its military power on Iran, what might that look like?
Well, first of all, I think you're going to see, you know, a coalition. It's not just going to be the United States. If there is any some sort of action, you know, it's hard to know exactly what the president will direct. But what I think is most likely is that you will see very, very discreet and targeted airstrikes against key regime facilities that are essential to the regime continuing to be able to, you know, repress the Iranian people. The Iranian regime is the weakest that it has ever been. And I'm certain the president sees that as a window to apply both military and diplomatic pressure to achieve the results he wants.
What does success look like for America? You mentioned nuclear weapons and that threat. You mentioned the right to protest for millions of Iranians. And you mentioned Iran's alliance with China. Does that lead to the view in the Trump White House that what is needed in Iran is actually regime change?
Well, I think there's only really one person that knows if that's the ultimate objective. But I'll say this. The president has shown that whether it was the strikes he took last summer in Iran to set back the nuclear program, or whether it's the operation that he directed in Venezuela several weeks ago, he's consistently shown that he will only take action if there is a discrete and clear objective and end state. And so, you know, I suspect what's happening right now is the president is formulating that.
Do you think it matters, quite aside from whether or not Donald Trump cares about it, do you think it matters whether or not the US has legitimate authority and international support in its actions in Iran?
There's more than enough justification to use force. There's also certainly a strong self-defense justification from the perspective of the threats that Iran has been fueling against the United States and our forces and our interests. And so there's multiple justifications under, you know, what's accepted as international law for the president to take action.
What's the main lesson that you would draw from the Iraq experience, which was obviously a full-on invasion with regime change? What's the thing that America should take from that in terms of mistakes it ought not to repeat?
Well, look, the president's not looking to do one nation building, and he's not looking to put boots on the ground. He's been very clear. He does not want American boots on the ground in Venezuela, and he doesn't want American boots on the ground in Iran or other places in the Middle East or far off places. And that's why I say, you know, we're all very focused on, you know, the large military conventional force that we're seeing, but you should be certain that the president has many, many other levers he can pull.
Given what you say about our focus, can I ask you about another major naval military buildup, which is what China is doing in the South China Sea? It's very interesting that some of the big vessels that President Trump has moved to the Arabian Sea and the Gulf of Oman have come from the South China Sea. Meanwhile, there's lots of evidence that China itself is consolidating some of its vessels in the South China Sea, forming a kind of wall. And some people look at this as a potential preparation for what would be a very, very difficult invasion of Taiwan. To what extent would you warn that any action that America took in Iran may also be seen by China as the optimal moment to make some sort of move on Taiwan?
Well, the commander-in-chief and the Pentagon always have to balance readiness to respond to any sort of crisis around the world. What is clear is that the Chinese are engaged in this exercise. They're using civilian boats that are part of their naval auxiliary force. But the United States has the ability to dynamically deploy forces around the world and then quickly relocate them to another area of concern. That's something we're very good at, and that's what you're seeing today.
Ezra Cohen, Mr. Cohen, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the Today program.
Thank you.
It is 23 minutes past 8. Now, 100 years ago this week, everything that we thought we knew about the way the physical world around us is put together, it changed because Erwin Schrödinger, the Austrian physicist, published his theory of quantum mechanics, explaining the nature of matter and the forces that give rise to the universe. It underpins chemistry, molecular biology, particle physics, material science, and many of the inventions that have changed our lives. Well, the theoretical physicist Jim Al-Khalili is Distinguished Professor Emeritus at the University of Surrey and presenter of The Life Scientific here on Radio 4. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
I very, very deliberately there talked about it, but didn't actually explain what it is because I thought you would be far better placed than me to do that.
Well, you know, there's the famous quote by one of the founders, not Schrödinger, but Niels Bohr, who said, if you're not astonished by quantum mechanics, you haven't understood it. So in a few minutes radio program, I don't even think I'm going to try explaining what it means. But certainly Schrödinger, what we're celebrating this week is the publication of his paper, which first showed the equation that's named after him. The Schrödinger equation is the most equation, I would argue, in all of science, not just in physics, because it underpins so much of how the world is made up at the tiniest level of atoms.
Yeah. And what did it broadly, what did it tell us?
Well, the equation is what's called a wave equation. So it describes the way, as Schrödinger first applied it, the way electrons fit inside atoms. So we think of the atom as this miniature solar system with these tiny particles buzzing around the central nucleus. Schrödinger said, no, the electrons aren't little particles. They're waves of energy that sort of surround the atom. And his equation very accurately predicted how the electron in the hydrogen atom, that's the lightest, the smallest atom, the lightest element in the periodic table, how that electron gains energy. It can't just move around as it likes. It has to have certain what are called discrete energies. And people knew what those energies were. They'd measured them. His equation showed exactly, it predicted exactly what they should be. So that was, you know, the first big breakthrough, that he was onto something really huge.
How was it received at the time? Did people sort of, you know, did jaws drop and people say, wow, we hadn't realised this? Or was there any scepticism?
Well, both, actually, because around that time, in the mid-1920s, this was the hot subject, the new quantum theory describing atoms. All the theoretical physicists, you know, worth their salt, were working on it, mainly in Europe. There were rival ideas. So a few months earlier, another a German physicist, Werner Heisenberg, had come up with a different way of describing atoms that a lot of physicists didn't understand because it was too abstract. It was very mathematical. And then Schrödinger comes along with his wave equation. And a lot of physicists, particularly the old guard, heaved a sigh of relief. Oh, at last, someone sensible. Yes, these electrons are just waves of energy around atoms. So there were rival camps arguing about what is the reality of atoms at that point. Schrödinger's equation and Heisenberg's approach to this day are both still used. Okay. They're both correct, it turns out.
Jim, it's absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciated that.
My pleasure.
Jim Al-Khalil.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
26 minutes past eight, and here with some remarkable goings on in Melbourne at the tennis, it's Mike Williams.
Yeah, the first men's semi-final at the Australian Open is going the distance. Alex Zverev has fought back from two sets down against an injured Carlos Alcaraz to take the world number one into a fifth and deciding set. And in that set, Zverev, the world number three, has just broken Alcaraz. So the world number one on the ropes. If he wants to make a first Australian Open final, he has work to do. We'll hopefully be in Melbourne very shortly. In fact, we can head there now to the Rod Laver Arena and speak to Gigi Salmon. Alcaraz in a bit of trouble, Gigi.
He's in an awful lot of trouble now. 4 hours, 39 minutes on the clock. Zverev broke in the first game of this fifth set. Now, we believe that Carlos Alcaraz, who was completely in control for the first two sets, started to suffer cramp in the third, received treatment. You're not meant to receive treatment for cramp. He has not been the same player since. He did just have two break-back opportunities in the fourth game on the Zverev serve. He was not able to capitalise. So if the German keeps holding, he will find himself back in the final of the Australian Open. He leads 3-1 in the fifth. We now have a game point for Alcaraz for 2-3 in this deciding set.
A grandstand finish awaits. You can follow that match on BBC Sounds. We now, though, are going to talk cricket because England continue their build-up to next month's World Cup later this afternoon. They take on Sri Lanka in the first of three T20 matches in Palakkelly. And we can look ahead to that now with the former England batter David Milan, who joins us live on the programme. Hi, David.
Hi, guys.
So this is all about fine-tuning, isn't it, ahead of that T20 World Cup, a tournament England have won twice, most recently in 2022. And they've got some momentum, haven't they, after clinching that ODI series against Sri Lanka earlier this week?
Yeah, they have. They played exceptionally well, actually, after that first defeat to come back and win so convincingly in Sri Lanka. But yeah, you're right. This is about fine-tuning. This is about getting ready for the World Cup. They'd obviously want to win this series, but it's also about getting guys game time in the middle, getting guys used to the conditions and getting the game plans that they want to execute for that World Cup. So, yeah, it's all about trying to do as much as they can to build up for this World Cup as they can in these three games.
And a real boost for England ahead of this first T20 later. Fast bowler Jofra Archer back in the team after recovering from an injury picked up during the Ashes. I mean, England's bowling attack is just a different prospect altogether, isn't it, when there is a fit Jofra Archer available?
Yeah, definitely. He's a massive asset for English cricket. You know, the poor guy's been through so many injury scares and things over the last couple of years. So it's great to see him back ahead of schedule. It's great to see him playing. It's great to see him getting some game time now and preparing for that World Cup. Because as you say, having Jofra Archer fit and available, it adds that extra dimension to England's team. You know, he's able to bowl the new ball at the death. He's able to come through the middle and rush people up. So, yeah, he's a great asset for English cricket. And hopefully he can stay fit and get through these games and be a big part of that England World Cup team.
Opener Ben Duckett misses this match with a bruised finger. So Joss Butler will open the batting. And a word on him, I think it's fair to call him a veteran now, Butler. A record equaling 401st appearance in an England shirt for Butler, standing alongside Jimmy Anderson. So you imagine over the next few days, Butler will go on to make that record his own. What about Butler, David? What a great servant to England he's been.
He has. I'd call him a great of English cricket as well, especially in the white ball arena. And it just shows how good he's been to be able to do it for so many years. He plays a really modern brand of cricket, the way he takes the game on, the way he always looks to attack, and to be so consistent at doing what he's done has been unbelievable. You know, I'd put him down, as I said earlier, as the greatest white ball player that's ever played for England. And it's great to see him play for England for so long, and hopefully for a hell of a long, lot longer till.
Yeah, he's still only 35. You'd think perhaps got a few more years left in him, as Joff has Joss Butler. Just finally then, David, looking ahead to the World Cup, as we say, we've got this three-match series first. The matches there taking place today, Sunday and next Tuesday. But then the World Cup starts in earnest a week tomorrow. What about England's chances at the World Cup? Do you think they could go all the way?
Yeah, I think so. I think they've got a really good team. I think if you look at their group that they've got initially with Nepal, West Indies, Scotland, Italy, it's quite an easy group for them, especially where they're playing as well. Eden Gardens and Mumbai, that would suit the wickets there, would suit the way they play. Very good batting wickets and allows them to be attacking. I think India would always be the favourites in India, in the host country. They're fantastic in playing in India. So England would have to have a really good game to beat India, or hope someone else knocks them out moving on. But, you know, if everything works their way, I think England have got a really well-balanced team. They've got really good spinners. And as you said, with the addition of Jofra being fit and their batters they've got, you know, I think they've got a very good chance in this World Cup.
All right, David Millar, former England batter, many thanks for joining us on the programme. As we say, that T20 International getting underway later this afternoon. Follow it online as you can, that gripping Australian Open men's semi-final, which is into a fifth and final deciding set. Carlos Alcaraz against Alex Zverev, the winner facing Novak Djokovic, or Jannik Sinner in the final on Sunday.
Watching that one very closely. Thank you, Mike. Now, Laura Laverne's here with Desert Island Discs in half an hour.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology.
My castaway is the leader of the Conservative Party, Kemi Badenoch.
Trust in politics is something that has degraded to such low levels. And I think the only way you can win trust back is by being honest, showing, not just telling, what kind of person you are.
Kemi Badenoch, my castaway. Do join us to hear her Desert Island Discs this morning at 9.
It is 28 minutes to 9. I can tell you about the weather. Cloudy for most, with patchy rain and hill snow in the north, with strong winds, heavy rain in the south and west, a few bright spells for Northern Ireland.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amol Rajan in London and Anna Foster in Salford. It is just coming around to 27 minutes to 9. Tom Sanders has a summary of the news.
President Trump says it would be dangerous for the UK to do more business with China. The Prime Minister is currently in the country attempting to strengthen economic ties. In response, Downing Street has pointed to the fact Donald Trump is due in China himself in April. The US president says he's told Iran that in order to avoid American military action, it must have no nuclear program and it must stop killing protesters. He said it would be great if he didn't have to use the very powerful US ships currently sailing to the country. Russia has reduced the number of drones and missile strikes on Ukraine after President Trump asked Vladimir Putin to pause airstrikes on the country's towns and cities for a week. Temperatures are forecast to drop as low as minus 30 Celsius. There are warnings that the attacks on energy plants and the harsh winter are leading to a humanitarian catastrophe. The National Audit Office says the Ministry of Defence has recovered less than half the money it spent on detecting and tackling fraud and theft over the past 4 years. Weapons and laptops were among the stolen items.
Thank you, Tom. Now, on the programme this morning, we're giving a really special and deep focus to how children's use of social media, phones, screen time, all of that plays out actually inside our homes, because the start of 2026 has seen a social media ban for young people brought in Australia. It's been debated in Parliament here in the UK, also in places like France, Austria, countries around the world, really. But what about right now, while those conversations are happening, what can we do as parents, as carers, to try and deal with the challenges that those things are bringing? And we asked you about how you are trying to navigate what is a really tricky and difficult area. We've had hundreds of messages about the conversations that you have with your children or with your grandchildren, the kind of limits or rules that you set. And also, and this is a tricky one, I know, the example that you try and give around your own phone use. Well, we're going to just try and be really useful with this. Dig into it, some hints, some tips and practical solutions as well. So with us for the next half hour, Justine Roberts, founder and executive chair of Mumsnet, has four children. The youngest is 19. The eldest are twins. They're 27 now. Dr. Charlotte Armitage is with us as well, a specialist psychologist and psychotherapist who focuses on parenting, device use and child development. She's got a 13-year-old daughter. And Keza McDonald is with us as well, video games editor at The Guardian, parent to three children, a 20-year-old stepchild and two younger children, 9 and 6 years old. Good morning to all three of you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Morning.
Good morning.
Justine, can you kick us off? Because one of the reasons that we're having this conversation this morning is that it is in the news so much at the moment, in lofty ways about banning phones from schools, banning under 16s from social media. But actually, and I'm sure your users will find this as well, some of the trickiest moments can be the ones in your house where you're saying no to a phone or it's time to come off, where it's just you and them and their decisions that you're having to make.
Yeah, I mean, on Mumsnet, I think what we see is a constant battle. Parents describe endless conflict on a daily basis around routines, around homework, around bedtime, where they are in a sort of battle stroke negotiation with their kids around screen time. And what starts out as a, you know, quick 10 minutes to keep them occupied while you're doing something quickly becomes a habit and a demand. And then you are basically, as a parent, battling the addictive algorithms of big tech and you feeling pretty guilty and pretty alone when you're doing it.
Yeah. What were the moments that you had, Justine, that you just found particularly challenging?
Well, I think, you know, my kids are a bit older. You make me feel very old when you say the name. Well, ages
sorry.
Of my kids.
That wasn't the plan.
So, I was part of that generation that's had a sort of inkling that it possibly wasn't that healthy to allow our kids to be on social media, but possibly weren't berating ourselves as much because we hadn't seen the evidence and we didn't grow up with this stuff. So we genuinely were a guinea pig generation. So I think whilst, you know, I think I looked at it at the beginning as, well, this is great. It's keeping them occupied. You know, they're safe. They're in the home. And it was only sort of as time developed that I think we became more aware that it was really, really, really addictive stuff. And it also, you know, my 27-year-olds didn't really do Insta until they were 16 or something. So that was, they were beyond the kind of really early age. So I think in my case, we kind of knew we were walking into something that we didn't know. It was the unknown, but we weren't as fully aware as of the risks.
As how it would end up. Keza, you've got as we said there, your job is that you're video games editor at The Guardian. So so many of our children throw back at us, which is, well, you're on your phone. And I will come back with something like, well, I didn't have a phone when I was your age. So if you want to wait till you're 19, feel free. And obviously that goes down like a lead balloon every time. But how do you, when it is your job and when you have to be doing that, how do you sort of manage those conversations that you're having at home?
Well, for us, not all screens are equal. I think this is something that shows up in the research a lot. But depending on what you're doing on a screen, especially with younger children, my children and I play lots of video games, probably more than most households. But we are doing that together as a family. We are generally having a lot of fun and a lovely time doing it. And I think that when I have to play a game for work, I try and do it as much as possible while they're at school, because then I don't have a leg to stand on when I say you've had your hour, your time's up. And I think that the distinction between, for instance, you know, unsupervised time online on an iPad and time together playing Pokemon is quite a big one for us and our family.
I was good. Charlotte, if I could bring you in, Dr. Charlotte Armitage, specialist psychologist and psychotherapist who focuses on parenting, device use and child development. I know, Charlotte, you've got a 13-year-old daughter. I should just say we've had so many emails. I hesitate there because I'm looking through some of them. We've had so many emails from listeners. I'm going to try and weave some of those in over the next 20 minutes or so. But Charlotte, can you just help us with the science here? Because some people would say it's contested and there's a lot of claim and counterclaim online. What do we know, Dr. Armitage, about the impact of various different types of smartphone usage or screen time on child development?
There's actually quite a lot of evidence out there. One of the biggest issues I would say is about attentiveness, so how it's eroding the attention of children in terms of their short-term memory, their ability to focus. We've got, you know, a plethora of evidence about the impact of mental health problems, but not to mention that there's also problems with development, with movement, with being sedentary, the impact that this has on the body. I think the issue with the science is that there are scientists and academics arguing that it's not causation, but we have to also look at the impact of sitting on an addictive algorithm device and not moving around, so and not interacting with the world. And that's the problem, is the interaction with the world, which is being compromised. Children need that interaction with the world for healthy development psychologically and physiologically as well.
Can I just very quickly, before I play, we got a tape of a conversation I had with Jonathan Haidt. Just before I play that in, can I mention something to you, Dr. Armitage, which is one of Haidt's points is that in the last 15 years, technology has been very effective at capturing our attention. And he says, as we move into the world of AI chatbots, and we heard on this programme less than an hour ago that 60% of teenagers have used AI chatbots for conversation, is there a sense in which technology, which came for our attention, is increasingly going to come for our attachments?
Absolutely. I mean, I think all of social media, it's having an impact on our interpersonal skills. It's having an impact on the relationships that we have around us. The problem with AI chatbots is it's constantly telling a child what it needs to hear. So it's never really learning how to have a healthy relationship. It can't take that out into the real world then. Not to mention that it's addictive and potentially problematic. You know, if a child's put, it's always going to reinforce what the child says, even if the child is saying something that could be harmful for that child.
Okay, well, let me just play in a bit of that tape so people can hear it for themselves, because next week our guest on the podcast Radical is Jonathan Haidt. He's the social psychologist and author of The Anxious Generation, which is a massive global bestseller, and it argues, and he argues, that widespread use of smartphones has caused caused a mental health crisis for young people. He was in the UK this week. He met with the Health Secretary Wes Streeting and others in Downing Street. He'd just been in Davos, but between Davos and Downing Street, he came in to see us, and we're releasing that episode in full next Thursday. But here's a short clip in which I asked Jonathan Haidt what his advice to parents and carers is when they're trying to manage their children's screen time.
I have incredible sympathy because I'm in the same situation. I made some mistakes. I did a good job on social media, but I didn't do a good job on device regulation. It's not your fault that there's this pressure for all kids to be on because all other kids are on. That's not your fault. So that's the prologue. So now, what are the principles? The first principle is, once you understand it's a collective action problem, that everyone is trapped, and if you try to get off and you're alone, you're in worse shape. Find allies. Find other families. Okay, so you're raising your kid in North London, you said?
Yeah.
How many kids? You have four kids?
Four.
Four. How many other families are there within walking distance for your 9-year-old?
Plenty. Plenty. Okay. Plenty.
So what you do is you form a playborhood. You say, hey, look, you know, do you want to have our kids have more of the kind of childhood we had? And let's say, you know, four of the seven families say yes. Okay, let's form a playborhood. The kids, you know, they can connect either by landlines. Americans are putting in landlines now again for the kids. Or when they start secondary school, they have a brick phone, a flip phone, whatever. The kids can connect. And the idea is all of our houses are open. The kids decide, and maybe it's just on Fridays. Maybe just do it on Fridays to start. Every Friday after school, the kids decide, we're going to start at Billy's house. And you might even say, you know, mom says we can play half an hour of video games if we're together.
You are decent enough to say you made mistakes when it comes to device regulation. Mm-hmm. What, looking back, what are some of the guidelines? This is not a sort of sanctioned manifesto. You're not seeking mm-hmm. office. But what are some of the guidelines you might say to parents? For instance, might you say no screens in bedrooms, no social media until a certain age? How would you do device regulation better?
Yeah. So let me give you two principles here. So the first principle, this is the one I wish I'd done, is no screens of any kind in bedrooms ever. Now, you can start that. When your kids are young, you can start that. And you can have a TV in the common room or family room or kitchen. You can have a computer. There are all kinds of reasons why they might use those. But you say no screens in the bedroom. When I was a kid, the idea that you'd have a TV in your bedroom was insane because you'd watch it all the time. So if you start with that rule when they're young, then they're not going to – the stuff is like a gas that expands to fill every moment. So if you have that rule, it won't fill every moment of your kid's day. The second is, let's talk about good screen time versus bad screen time. It's actually very simple. Here's what's good. Stories. Stories are good because humans are storytelling animals. Humans have always raised their kids in a sea of stories, inherited from previous generations with some modification. Our brains are like LLMs. Our brains are like, they are neural networks. They need lots of patterns. And fiction, stories, myths are the fastest way that we tune up, along with real experience and travel, things like that. So your kid needs a lot of that to get smart. The worst thing you can do is hand your kid a touchscreen device, because a touchscreen device is a little Skinner box. Stimulus, dopamine, response, reward, repeat over and over again. And it mostly ends at short videos. And the short videos are not stories. There's no morality. It's like a guy drilling holes in wood, followed by a cat falling.
Plenty more where that came from next Thursday. You can hear the full interview with Professor Jonathan Haidt on Radical from next Thursday morning. Just search for Radical with Amol Rajan on BBC Sounds.
And those bits of advice, those tips, those solutions, I think those are the things that we really appreciate at the moment. And thank you for your emails on that, by the way. We'll hear some of those in just a second. Keza, there was a specific scenario that I wanted to ask you about, which is how we deal with that moment when screen time comes to an end. So you're saying to a child, give me your phone or end this computer game now. And that, I find, is often a moment of real conflict. So how would you manage those moments?
One thing that is very different now than it was 10 years ago when I was raising my stepson is that almost every single device that a child might use has built-in parental controls that you can set up not only how much time is allowed on the device, but also what time it stops working. So that takes a lot of that argument out of your hands. If a kid's iPad, tablet, Nintendo Switch, if it turns itself off at 5:30 or 5:45, then you'll hear the groan from the other room.
You'll get shouted at from afar, yeah.
But you don't have to be the one who's then having that battle, or it's like, you know, dinner's on the table. Oh, just five more minutes. I'm nearly finished my match. Or, you know, I just need to finish one more round or whatever it is. The thing will turn itself off. That removes an awful lot of the interpersonal conflict from the screen time issue for me. And 10 years ago, these parental controls were just not very precise, and there was a lot of issues with them. Now they're really good. Whatever you have, whether it's an Android device, an Apple device, or a games console, they're really good now. If you dig into how the parental controls work, they're not that difficult to use, and they're very, very precise, which is important for families.
Just on the practical tips, Anna, I should say absolutely loads of listeners have been in touch. I'll just read a couple of the emails with practical tips. This is from Robert. Robert, thank you so much for your message. He says, when our two boys were toddlers, we introduced TV tickets. They were given some printed vouchers with hour and half hour denominations every week, a bit like pocket money. They could, quote, cash in tickets for time watching TV, or as they got older, time on their screens. If they were naughty, one or more tickets were confiscated, depending on the crime. if they did something especially kind, they would get a few extra. Joe says, banning or limiting screen time is lazy parenting. It's not about how much they are consuming, but what they are consuming, a bit like Keza was saying, and how regulated the child is afterwards. And what else do you introduce to get your child interested other than TV or games? I have a six-year-old. If he watches a high-energy episode of Paw Patrol, he's jumping around the room. If he watches a calming episode of Bluey, which is a brilliant Australian cartoon for those who don't know, or plays a problem-solving computer game, he feels good and learns important life lessons.
One thing which I think is useful is a change in who these messages are coming from. So it's not necessarily parents or adults telling children what to do. If it comes from somebody in your own generation, it can sink in a little bit more easily. And Olivia Yocobonis is a content creator. She goes by the name Olivia Unplugged online, and she makes videos specifically to combat overuse or mindless use of social media. And she's got this advice for parents to manage their own screen time as well as their children's.
I think that the biggest change that I have been able to make within my own life is by introducing friction. So there's this common experience that we all have where you go, you have one simple task to complete on your phone, responding to a text message or looking at an email or doing something for work. And you go, you click on it, all of a sudden your thumb is on TikTok or it's on YouTube or it's on Instagram, and it's been 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and you lose this time and you come back and you say, what was I even doing? And using something that actually allows you to set limits and boundaries. So when your willpower fails, it's no longer an issue. You already have a fail safe. And I think something that we have to recognize is that it's not our fault. So there are kids out there that use tools without being forced to, that help them reclaim their time. And although I'm not a parent, I have a lot of children in my life, and I've learned that leading by example is the first step.
That's Olivia Unplugged. Let's also hear from Rita, a 22-year-old Today listener who got in touch with us this week about her own experience of having a smartphone in her teens. Hi, Rita.
Hi.
How was it for you? Positive, negative?
My phone being a teenager.
Yeah.
I look back on it in quite a negative way. I think this is similar to lots of my peers around me. I feel like many of us feel like we lost our teenage years to our phones and too much screen time because it was completely unregulated. But I think it meant, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, what were the hardest things that you found about it?
Well, I think it's the addictive nature of it, and it's actually really hard to control. I also think teenage years can be difficult socially, and it exaggerates that and provides a platform for kids to be pretty mean to each other or say things that, you know, they wouldn't say in real life.
Yeah, that's true. Did you sometimes struggle to have that moment where you think to yourself, I'm going to come off now? Because it's designed to be addictive. It's designed to draw you in. Did you find it hard to break that spell and come off?
Definitely. And I think I had my generation have had quite a unique experience where in schools it was completely unregulated. At home, it felt like it was completely unregulated. And I guess I feel excited about a future where it does become more regulated, because I think we've learned how to manage our screen time, and it often feels like we're more aware of how addictive it is compared to the older generation. But I feel like children and young people don't need to learn those lessons by themselves or learn those lessons through the extremities of how addictive it is.
Yeah, that fits in with what Justine was saying as well. It's something we're only now realising what a challenge it is. I also wondered, Rita, as well, because one thing that I find is that peer pressure can be an issue. So if you're saying to your child, I want you to come off at this time, but their friends are all still on, they're still messaging, they're still doing something, the idea that your child might be left out, they might look a bit babyish, they might not be online when their friends are, was that something you ever found?
Yeah, I'm sure I did. But I think I almost feel like the debate has become too much about control and what happens when we say to that children or provide that child with different opportunities to go have fun outside or interact in a different way. And I think that's, you know, the government should be providing those opportunities and parents themselves. And if it's more about education than about saying no to them, because of course a teenager doesn't understand why you might be trying to protect them in that way.
Well, can I pick up on that point actually with Justine Roberts, if I may, Anna, because Justine's nodding. Justine, how do you go about getting collective action, which is what a lot of parents or mums now presumably want?
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to be the one parent that says no, because you are effectively socially isolating your kid and you will be seen as unreasonable. I mean, for me, you go about collective action. Collective action is a government problem. And for me, we need a ban, you know, and that's not just me. 83% of our users say we need a ban.
How do you do it at secondary school?
How do you do what?
Collective action at secondary school with other parents. Any tips for how you do that?
Well, I think it's really difficult because, as you probably know, I'm not quite sure how old your kids are, but it's very hard to persuade teenagers to do anything. So the idea, I think there are lots of tools and tips that help with young children, but it gets harder and harder as peer pressure arrives and kids get older. And this is why I think, you know, our users say 61% say their kids are addicted. This is really hard to control. To control a teenage addict, it's, you know, yeah. I don't think it is by having play dates, to be honest, arranging play dates. So I do think government needs to get involved here, and so do our users. And I think this is a crisis that you can't expect parents to control.
Mine are 9, 6, 4, and 2, since you asked.
Oh, you're still okay.
Okay, that's one way to describe it. Let me bring in Anthony Walker, Deputy CEO of Tech UK, the trade association, whose members include the social media companies. Anthony, you represent Tech UK, you're also a parent. You're nodding along vigorously because these are familiar challenges.
Yeah, look, I'm very much all part of, you know, my lived experience of bringing up an 11-year-old. So I think these are very familiar challenges. And I think what we're hearing very clearly, I think, is a message that parents want a bit more help. And I think the experience of what's happening in Australia in terms of where they've gone for a, you know, looking to ban, particular platforms for under 16s is an approach. But I think we need to understand more about, well, what are the real world implications of that approach? I think there are big questions about, are you just displacing activity?
Yes.
Are children just going to other platforms? So you're not really addressing, you know, sure, the screen time question. And then there are other questions about, are you potentially pushing children into less well-regulated,
yes,
less well-understood parts of the internet as well? And so I think, you know, whilst we fully understand the pressure that it's coming through from parents and I think politicians are responding to that, I think there's a real opportunity actually to sort of learn from the real life experience of Australia before we kind of rush to judgment on whether a social media ban is the right approach or whether there are other ways we can address
it. But also whether or not you're legislating and controlling for yesterday's problem. I mean, social media has developed over the last 10 years, as Justine was saying, when her kids were a bit younger. We're now in the foothills of AI.
Yeah.
And one of the things about AI is the evidence is unclear. So, for instance, on the question of chatbots, whether they're addictive, the evidence is not yet in because we haven't had time to gather the evidence. What do you think we need to do now to try to get ahead of where this trend is going, particularly in relation to AI and chatbots?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's not well understood about the Online Safety Act is actually that it's been quite well designed to take account of changing technologies. So essentially what it says is if you run a platform where there's a reasonable expectation that children are going to be on your platform, then you've got to proactively think about the risks that children could encounter, and then you've got to demonstrate what mitigations you've made against those risks. And so the smart thing about that is it takes account of changes in technology. So in terms of new AI tools that are coming along, the same principles should apply. Now, there might be sort of technical issues about some of the definitions in the legislation that means some things sit inside and some things sit outside. But that's Ofcom's job, I think, to identify those. And if there are gaps and if there are problems, then government needs to kind of regulate to kind of fix those gaps. But I think the basic principle is a good one. If you're running a service where there's a reasonable expectation that children are going to be on your service, then you have to take measures. And what we've seen is a lot of the social media platforms over the last couple of years, you know, have been moving to things like teen accounts and so on, where they're trying to make those experiences more appropriate for children, because we definitely learn a lot more about what that means.
We've actually come a long way. Years. All right, yeah. Anthony, thank you.
Dr. Charlotte Armitage is still with us, specialist psychologist and psychotherapist. Charlotte, you've got a 13-year-old, I've got a 13-year-old, and I'm hearing really good advice about, you know, keep screens out of bedrooms, limit time. But when you're already in a world where those things have happened and you're trying to row back again and not make it look like a punishment and have conversations that slightly older children might be better at, how do you deal when you're already in that world and you're trying to pull back?
I think it's really important to have conversations that come from a place of care. So talking to the child or the teenager about the reasons why you want to limit their device use, rather than it being a punishment. So saying, you know, you're aware that this is bad for them. I did this with my daughter years ago when I first started working in this area, and I sort of said, look, you know, you're not going to be allowed to use any of these devices anymore. I've been working in it. I know how harmful it is. It would be neglectful of me as a parent working in this to let you use them. And just I started having those conversations with her quite young. So now it's just not a problem that she's not allowed them. In fact, she kind of agrees with that herself. I think with older teenagers, it's about creating some sort of agreement within the household. So having a discussion with them about what they would want you to change as well, because I think it's about everybody coming together. So ask them, how would they want you to change your device use? You talk about how you'd want them to change. And meet in the middle somewhere so that it isn't just them that's having to give something up, but you are as well. I mean, to talk about this in my book, Generation Zombie, but the four things that I'd say are no devices in the bedroom, ideally no devices at the dinner table. Have a space where you all charge your devices downstairs together and create some zones and boundaries. Ideally, we just want teenagers to become more consciously aware. I mean, it's going to be very difficult to expect a teenager to regulate their use of social media, given how addictive it is and given that their brain is still developing impulse control. And the best way of trying to deal with this at home is by setting some boundaries regarding how the device itself is used.
And making them really clear. It's worth saying, by the way, everything we've talked about in this last half hour, if you've missed any bits of it, you can listen again on BBC Sounds or put it on the Today socials as well. So all of those hints and tips you can actually hopefully benefit from.
Justine, a very final thought. If you're honest, are you addicted to your phone?
Yes. And I think we all are, and this is why we need a government
which
intervene.
Exactly. Justine Roberts from Mumsnet, Charlotte Armitage from...